からもっともっと高く高く背伸びしてみてみたいよ。ビルより高く窓際から手を振るあの子を照れ笑い隠せなくて目を背けたんだ。
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here probably for the last time this year in 2017.
Yeah.
To talk about stuff this week on the show specifically, we're doing one of our favorite episodes to do every year, which is the top 10 video games of the year, in this case 2017.
Yeah.
2017, once again, not a good year for the world.
No. Oh, no.
No.
It definitely was not.
We've talked about it, you know.
Yes, this has been the most political year for this podcast by far.
Yes, so, you know, the world did suck, asterisk. We'll just make sure that's noted. But we're going to try to have fun tonight and celebrate something that was, I think, unabashedly good about 2017.
Yes,
which
almost distressingly so.
Almost distressingly so is there were a lot of really good video games this year. And they provided a wonderful platform to escape and understand the world around us. So, Sean, we're not doing stuff or news or anything now. You can go to our last podcast for that. We talked about Star Wars and everything else, and it was fun. But we are just talking about the top 10 games of the year. And I think you and I have both said a lot this year that this was a pretty special year for video games.
Definitely.
And we said that a lot last year, too.
It was true then as well.
I think this was maybe even better.
Yeah. I would say on average, yes. They are both... It's been a good time for video games. It's been a bad time for almost everything else.
Yes, but video games have been great. Sean, what made 2017 special in your mind?
It's just a lot of stuff. I mean, for me, probably the biggest thing is like just how dominating the Japanese side of things was this year. Like, it was absurd. I mean, I'm sure you're going to talk about a lot of stuff with the Nintendo Switch, and I did not get a Switch yet this year. But out of my list... There are a lot of Japanese games, and particularly once you get near the top, there are a lot of Japanese games, and there are...
6 out of the 10 on my list.
Yeah, it was just an absurd year for video games coming from Japan. It's been an absurd year for video games in general, but it is just... I don't know, it's been nice seeing that, like, what feels like this fresh surge of creativity, that, like, the video game market was so dominated by the West... for so long in the, like, 360 PS3 generation. And then with this generation, it felt like bit by bit by bit, the Japanese market sort of started growing and getting bigger and getting more influential and more creative. And the games coming out of Japan started seeing more success over here into a way that, like, with this year, it's been, like, everything for me. Like, it's just been... They've done genres that we thought we expected in ways that we now unexpect, and they've told stories in ways that I would have never anticipated, and it's just been incredible.
A resurgent Sony, you know, and all the other developers that publish on PlayStation platforms,
yeah,
plus a resurgent Nintendo, is a really powerful combination to waste the fuck out of our times.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like... And that absolutely for me was one of the stories of this year, is that the PlayStation 4 chugged along to its best year to date, I think.
Yeah,
if you just look at the number of exclusives and the number of great things published on that platform. While Nintendo surged to its best year in a long time, when you look at just how great the Nintendo Switch was right out of the gate, I think easily the best first year a home console has ever had, if you look at the sheer lineup that system, and how healthy it seems just, you know, a year into it. Like, that is a robust system to go out and buy. And the 3DS also had a stellar, kind of, you know, one of its waning years. So, all of that combined, even though Xbox was basically off the map this year entirely, it didn't matter. You know, and I do think that's one interesting thing to talk about how resurgent Japan has been. Xbox and Microsoft being such a Western-focused platform, completely off the map this year.
Yeah.
They released the Xbox One X, no one really seemed to care, and they had no interesting exclusives to speak of. They had a couple of indie things like Cuphead that people liked, but, you know, nothing that drove that platform. Like, honestly, the most barren year I've maybe ever seen for a major platform. Not at the end of its lifespan, either.
Yeah, no. Like, it is, like, contrasted by, like, Sony, who, like, they, on my list, like, there is one, two. There are two games on my list that are available on an Xbox One.
Yeah.
So,
and there's only one game that's available on Xbox One on my list, and I didn't play it there. So this is the first year since I've owned one that Xbox does not show up on my top 10 whatsoever.
Yeah.
And would only show up on my top 20, which I'll tell you about later, if you extend to like some other multi-platform games. But yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. One of the other trends that I think was so interesting in 2017, and it really bears out on my list, is that this was a year where a lot of, like, you know, well-defined franchises came out with bold new entries. Like, not just good, like, this was a good, like, middling entry in this series. Like, bold, fresh, innovative. Like, if you look at just how many games that at least are on my list, I don't know about yours, but at least in the conversation this year, are parts of larger franchises, you might say, oh, that sounds like 2017 was stale. And I get that, but, you know, gaming is so built around innovating on existing ideas and properties, and this is not a year that felt stale at all to me, especially because, you know, when franchises were good, they were often good in new and exciting ways.
Yeah.
And that was a big story for me this year.
Yeah, that's definitely been a big thing. Another thing for me has just been, like, with my list, especially, like, when I was sort of getting to the top of my list, I realized that for me, personally, like, this year has been defined by, one, it's been defined by games that are really fucking long. Because some of these games are really fucking long, but also just like some of the most interesting pieces of storytelling I've ever seen in games has come out this year. And like for a couple of them, some of those interesting pieces of storytelling I've seen kind of almost bar none.
And
that's been an incredible thing for me.
And it's interesting. I agree with that in certain directions. This is also by far the top 10 list, the most I've had on a top 10 list of non-narrative games.
Hmm.
Or games with, not non-narrative, but often minimalistically narrative, or the narrative is not like the main central feature. And I actually like that, because I like that games can innovate on narratives. And you're right, there's a lot of interesting ones this year. I also like that we can have, you know, a good conversation about games that, because game is one of the only like visual mediums at this point that doesn't always feel the need to be about a linear narrative.
Right.
And that's something very powerful about the medium to me. And I think 2017 was full of that. So yeah. Also something I note in the written introduction of my list, just exclusives this year. And we talked about that a little bit, but like, PlayStation, you know, I mostly kept up with PlayStation 4 and Nintendo Switch this year, and all but one of the games on my list is an exclusive in one way or another.
Yeah.
And that's really incredible. That's never happened in that numbers for me on a list, where just like multi-platform games weren't even really part of the conversation this year for anyone, except here and there a little bit.
There are two multi-platform games on my list. That's like one of them's like a smaller multi-platform game. And there's not. It was, like, and usually, like, at least half, if not more than that, on my list would have been a multi-platform game.
Yeah, like Doom last year, things like that. But Hitman, and it just was not a factor this year, and very interesting. And I think that shows an industry that is, at least creatively, very healthy, because that means that these platforms are supporting interesting, innovative art, and that's really cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, before we dive into our accolades and everything, quick recap from 2016, Sean.
Okay.
Let's do that just a little bit. What was your game of the year last year?
It was, well, that's more complicated than it probably should be. I think my number one game from last year was Hitman. Let's say that.
Because your number zero was Persona 5, but did you decide ultimately to rank it with this year's games?
We'll find out.
Okay. Probably. Anyway, so your game of the year last year was Hitman. Mine was Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth.
Yes, that was my number three game of the year. I just brought up my
my
list from last year.
So has that held for you? Hitman still your number one of 2016?
I've played a lot of Hitman this year as well.
Yeah. No.
It's still a thing for me.
That'll tie into my next question, but I was just going to say, like, I have to say, Sean, naming Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth my number one game of the year last year is the least I've ever regretted a top 10 list decision for movies, TV, games, anything ever. Like amazing how little I have regretted that choice. That totally was my game of the year last year. But that was a fun thing to think about. But here's something else. I wanted to ask this question because I think it is fun to look back a little bit. And your game of the year last year is my answer for this, which is, what game from 2016 did you most underestimate looking back? Like, either it didn't place on your list, or it placed too low. For me, it's definitely Hitman, which I actually did not include on my top 10 last year.
Right.
Going back to it, I wish I would have found a place for it. But I played it more this year than I did last year, and I think the things they added only made it better this year. And that's a game that I kind of got around to with time, but that's definitely one for me. Because it's also a kind of an ongoing game, is one I really discovered maybe outside of that window. Was there anything like that for you?
I think, like, looking at that, some of the games I have listed here from last year, I think the closest is No Man's Sky in that, like, weird story mode they put out this year, and I put, like, a dozen or so hours into that, and that was, like, interesting. But, like, I still think that that's a really cool thing. If you have No Man's Sky and you haven't gone back and looked at that, that is a thing well worth looking at, because it is a much more sort of, like, full, complete experience now. Yeah, there's No Man's Sky, and then, like, yeah, Hitman just keeps on. I wouldn't say I ever underestimated Hitman.
No.
But I just never stopped playing Hitman was more of the thing.
It's always something to go back to. So, before we get to the top 10 list itself, Sean, you always have stupid awards. Do you have stupid awards?
Well, so, yeah, this year, I've sort of had to format it differently, because what I discovered in putting together my, like, list was that I played far fewer games this year than I did last year. Like, last year I played something like, I think, over 20 games, and it was absurd. This year I played about 15 games to, like, more or less, like, to completion, like, touched some other ones. But, like, so not quite enough to be able to do what I did last year, where I had, like, a bunch of awards for, like, a bunch of different games, because there were a lot of games on my list that I wanted to recognize that couldn't be in my top 10. But this year, just what happened was I have 4 games that I spent at least over 100 hours on this list. So, and then, like, some that are, like, close to that. So it was more this year for me was wanting to get to a lot of smaller games, but, like, being fatigued enough from playing these, like, diving incredibly deep into these really big games that I just, like, it was like my, like, life was one video game, and then I just, like, went cold turkey off of video games for a week and then moved to another huge video game. That was, like, I've never quite done that before.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I actually did play, I think, more than I've maybe ever played this year in terms of the number of games I got through, because I have a full listed top 20. We're going to do the top 10, and I'll give you my next 10 at the end just to tell you. But, like, and that came about from I just started listing honorable mentions at the end, and it's like, oh shit, that came out to another 10 titles. And my count of every game on my, like, list of, like, I played this year that I throw together was almost 40 games.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't play all of those to completion. That includes things like Mass Effect Andromeda that I put away after 5 hours or so. But just, like, just to remind myself of all the titles, that list was really long this year.
Yeah.
And so it was competitive. I have to say, like, going through the year, it was interesting to me because, you know, as I go through the year, I often consider some games locks. Like, I'll get to this game, and it's like, that has to be on my top 10 somewhere. By the end of the year, I had 9 that I considered locks, which is ridiculous. Usually I have more room to maneuver. And then there were just a bunch of games fighting for number 10, and you'll see how that bore out. But did you have something to share before the list then?
So like, I have 3 honorable mentions that we'll get to.
Okay.
And then, so what I did, because I have, like, secretly my favorite part about doing this is just coming up with the stupid awards to give to games, I redid it to where now, if for each of the games in my top 10, they are given, like, supplementary awards
okay.
for, like, the specific things that they've achieved. But one of the other things I did, because I just want to read this list of, I made a list of, and this is probably incomplete because I did it mostly off the top of my head, but list of games that I wanted to play this year
okay.
and didn't get around to, and then I'll note, like, some of these games I own and just haven't even had time to play yet. So, like, Cuphead is one. PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds is one that, like, I'm still curious about, like, what the experience of actually playing that game is.
I'd love to play it on Xbox if it weren't broken.
Yeah, that's the whole different conversation. But Super Mario Odyssey, obviously I don't have a Switch, so that's not in the immediate future for me. What Remains of Edith Finch, which is that sort of walking simulator game that came out this year, never got around to that. Night in the Woods, another narrative-focused game, never got around to that. Call of Duty World War II, that one I'm not, like, super invested in the idea of getting, but it occurred to me, I was like, oh, I didn't do Call of Duty this year, and that's kind of been a thing for me recently. Gundam Versus was a game that came out this year that probably nobody listening to this podcast knows about, that is currently on sale for, like, $30, and my part of me wants to get it, and then part of me is like, I'm not going to have fucking time to play this game. Why? Like, I should wait, and it'll be on sale for, like, $5 sometime midway through last year. That's just an obscure, like, Gundam Versus game. Assassin's Creed Origins, I have that game. I have not loaded it up yet, but I have it. there were a whole slew of visual novels, of Western visual novels that came out this year that I never got around to any of them. One of them, Doki Doki Literature Club, is free on Steam. And I have it, obviously, because it's free, but I haven't put any time to it. There's Dream Daddy. There's, what's the name of the baseball
Butterfly
one?
Soup.
Butterfly Soup. There's that one. Never got around to that one either. I think there are a couple of other, like this is a weird year for Western visual novels, which is not something you usually see. Pyre, which is the game from the studio that made Bastion and Transistor. Never got around to that. Evil Within 2, that horror game. Never got around to that. The Dishonored 2 Death of the Outsider expansion, which I've heard from people is the best Dishonored thing that they've ever made. Never got around to that. Prey, similar to Dishonored, never got around to that. Hellblade Sinuous Sacrifice, I do have this one, but just not had the time to play it. And then finally, Resident Evil 7, the game I've wanted to get around to all year, and just like October and November. That's the other thing for me this year was October and November for me this year is maybe the busiest I've ever been in like my whole life. So like there was not a huge amount of time for game playing then. And then what time there was for game playing was not time I wanted to spend playing a game that is all about like mental illness.
Yes. No, I understand. I got around to most of what I truly wanted to play. My regrets would be from like the list you said. Like, there's things like Resident Evil 7 that like, I would have liked to play, but I doubt it would have been a real contender.
Yeah, it would not have been on my top 10.
Prey, I do wish I had played, because I saw my brother playing that, and it seemed cool. Doki Doki Literature Club, I actually did try to make an effort to play before this podcast, and I felt like it's the kind of thing I would want to play in one kind of go, because it's a short visual novel. Never just got around to it. I do have it on my computer as well. Maybe a couple others, but honestly, like things like, again, that would have been like luxuries, like Call of Duty World War II, I would have liked to have fun with that. Yeah. I don't feel that bad for it. Even stuff like, you know, I did play enough of Xenoblade Chronicles 2 to realize it wasn't for me. So got to it, I just didn't play the whole thing. So
you're not burning to play Gundam Versus?
I mean, I'm sure it's good. I'm just not, as into Gundam as you are.
Because that's the other answer to your, like, the game from 2016 that you underestimated was Gundam Breaker 3, my number 10 game from last year. I still stand by that.
I'm not saying you shouldn't. I just don't know anything about Gundam.
Well, maybe you should.
Also, didn't you have to buy that from, like, Hong Kong or something?
Yes, I imported it, the English Hong Kong version, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so it's not like it's a, like, readily available game to everyone here.
No, but you can get... I got it, so you could get it.
All right, so Sean, you want to, like, get started talking at least about the top 10?
Sure, yeah.
All right. So, top 10, we always ask this question, kind of, how did you go about assembling it? What was the process? How difficult or easy was it for you?
It honestly was not nearly as hard as I was expecting it to be. Again, because like it was not as hard as last year's, because last year's I just had so many games, and I had to cut, like I remember last year, Inside never made it on my list, which is still, like, I stand by that list and I stand by that choice, but it still blows my mind that that game never was not a top 10 game from last year. And really, like, what kind of happened this year was as I was playing the games over the course of the year, in the back of my mind, like, I was putting things together, and there were a couple of, like, hard choices I had to make about, like, which game was better than this other game, but, like, that was a decision that, like, it was like I put it in like a subroutine in the back of my brain, and like it just worked through that calculation until a couple of nights ago I finally sat down, opened up this Word document that I had typed all the games I'd been playing throughout the year, and I just put their names in there, and then like that list of like games that I wanted to play, and I just saw those games and put together a list, and it took me like 5 minutes, and I was like, oh, that was it was the easiest it's ever been for me, mostly because I had been doing the decision making, I think, like kind of subconsciously throughout the whole year.
It's weird. I had a similar process to you, and because I ran through this in my head a lot over the course of the year. My top three have been my top three for a while now, so they've been the top three in the order they've been for a while now.
Also,
and that was the easiest part. Like, committing to it is always, but it was like, yeah. I know these are the top three. Then, like, 4 through 9, I knew they all had to be on there, and ranking them was difficult, but they were all comfortably there. And then number 10 was, like, literally I had 6 games I was considering for number 10, and it was like I, got out the discs and, like, played little parts of them and watched videos and, like, had to feel it in my heart which one had to be, which one would hurt me the most to not be represented in that inner circle.
Yeah, for me, that is, like, number 10 for me was kind of just a coin flip, like, both of them were games that's like, either of these could be on here for, like, kind of for different reasons. And then, like, the other one was, when we get to my number 9 game, it was, maybe people have guessed, but it was a late entry. It came in super hot, and it came in, and it could be higher on this list if I had more time to play it. But that was like the wild card this year was this one game that I came to really late. It was like, this was the one I had no idea where it was going to go until I sat down for the list because I was still and am still in the middle of playing it.
Awesome. All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and get started? Sean, I kicked us off last year, so you're going to kick us off this year.
Okay.
Number 10, what is your number 10 game of 2017?
My number 10 game of 2017 is Uncharted The Lost Legacy, which this was, again, this is the one that was a coin flip for another game that we'll talk about, I guess, when we get to the honorable mention stuff. But Uncharted The Lost Legacy was, like, I was so shocked by how good that game was for me. And it was something that I knew I would, like, was excited for it. I knew I wanted to play more Uncharted. I knew Uncharted 4 was fantastic and wanted more excuses to go back to that game and engage with the combat and stuff like that. But I don't think I had ever anticipated that it was going to be quite as exceptional as it was in terms of the pacing, in terms of the experimentation of the small, like miniature open world in the middle of that game, and then just the characters and then sitting with Chloe and Nadine and those characters and getting to know them and seeing like Chloe's story arc over the course of the game and feeling so invested in that because I think, you know, Naughty Dog is the best at this business at what they do, and what they do is create these like very compelling, interesting, fleshed out characters that can exist in a like big flashy action game. And most of the time those things are completely contradictory. And most of the time, if it's a really great action game, it probably has really shitty characters and really, really shitty storytelling, and you just skip through most of the cutscenes or don't even pay attention. And in Uncharted The Lost Legacy, it was just like, almost like, you know, not quite to this level, but if you compare it to a movie, it was like Mad Max Fury Road. It was just like, nothing of this could be cut. This is perfectly paced. All of it's interesting to me. I'm so invested in the characters, and I'm so invested in the action and the spectacle of all of it. And in some ways, Uncharted The Lost Legacy is kind of like secretly maybe the best Uncharted game.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy thing. And so my supplemental award I gave to Uncharted The Lost Legacy is another version of an award I actually gave last year for the game Virginia. It's the Please Do More of This award, which is both like specifically, I'm not done with Uncharted. Like, I want more Uncharted specifically in this format. But then also broadly speaking, I think like this is such a like necessary direction for AAA gaming to go, is this like cheaper, you know, it's like $40, like smaller scale, like relatively smaller studio, but with access to the kinds of resources that AAA studios have, and be able to like create a really focused game that does not have to have loot boxes and like multiplayer modes shoved in and you know, like 100 different like alternate modes and bullshit to try to extend the game out to force me to play it for 100 hours or something. Just like make this super tight 6 to 8 hour campaign that's really interesting and is more affordable, and that I can just buy this and play it in one evening and be like, that was fantastic. And like, the video game industry desperately needs more of that going forward. We desperately need more smaller experiments that can still have the kind of fidelity that AAA games have. And Uncharted The Lost Legacy is brilliant.
Yeah. Uncharted The Lost Legacy appears on my list a little higher.
Okay.
And I'll tell you when cool. We get there. I'll say one thing about it now before I forget, because I think this is a good line. I don't know if I would say Uncharted The Lost Legacy is the best Uncharted game. Like, it's a hard thing to say.
Yeah, it's hard to put it up to Uncharted 4 because they're different.
But I'll say this. If you ask me right now, Jonathan, you have a free day tomorrow. You get to play one Uncharted game. Which one do you replay? It's The Lost Legacy.
Yeah.
Kind of like No Doubt. I want to play that game again so fucking bad.
Yeah.
All right. My number 10 game of the year is the first game of the year I played. And that's Gravity Rush 2.
Okay.
Gravity Rush 2 is a game for me defined by ambition. It is a game that takes a PS Vita, you know, foundation, which is what the original game was, which was already one of the most, like, thoroughly original and ambitious games in, like, the history of 3D video games, the original Gravity Rush. And Gravity Rush 2 says, we are going to severely up that ante. You know, they add so much in this game, moving it to PS4, bigger visuals, bigger worlds to explore, two new sets of gravity powers that expand and alter the gameplay more than I think you might think on the outside looking in, you know, bigger, denser open world. And it's insane how much the story is extended here. We talked about this a lot on the podcast, that Gravity Rush 2 is essentially Gravity Rush 2, 3, and 4 all in the same package.
Yeah.
Like, if James Cameron were to release all his Avatar sequels in one day, it would kind of feel like Gravity Rush 2. And I think that leads to some issues. I do think Gravity Rush 2 is imperfect. I think, you know, It suffers from a bit of open world bloat in places to me, and I think the middle act of the game, what we would call Gravity Rush 3,
right,
is the slowest stretch of the entire series. But what it kept coming back to for me when I was deciding for the number 10 game, like, which game would I feel the worst leaving off this list, it was Gravity Rush 2, because there's literally never been anything like this game before other than Gravity Rush 1.
Right.
And I think the way Gravity Rush 2 leaves everything on the table, everything that can be left, it leaves on the table, there will never be another game like Gravity Rush 2.
Yeah.
If you don't, you know, like, play and appreciate this game now, you're not going to have the chance to evangelize for it later. You know?
Yeah.
Not that they're going to erase it. I just mean, like, this is its moment, and it is such a special thing for all the reasons we've talked about that, you know, it is so singular in its art style, in its character design, in how it treats and builds its characters, in its music, which is so fucking good.
It's so good.
In its cutscene style, which is amazingly good with those comic book panels. Like, I could look at that all day. Gravity Rush 2 is a just phenomenal game, and I remember the other night I was working on this list, and I booted up Gravity Rush 2, and I just went into the open world, and I found a place where there were a bunch of gems I hadn't collected, and I collected gems for about 5 minutes, and I knew. It was just like collecting gems, flying around with this gravity, hearing that music, putting different costumes on Cat, who is an all-time great, you know, video game protagonist. Gravity Rush 2 is a major accomplishment, and we might never see anything quite like it again, so appreciate it while you can.
Yeah, yeah. Gravity Rush 2 features also on my list a little bit higher up, let's say.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is a brilliant game. As you say, it is purely and utterly singular, and people should get around to playing it. Like, play Gravity Rush Remastered and Gravity Rush 2, because those games are brilliant.
I don't have any silly awards.
Okay.
Cat has a Nier Automata costume that's
she
DLC.
Does now, yes.
That was pretty fun.
Yes.
That's not an award, just an
It's also like Gravity Rush 2 is one of, if not maybe like, in some ways the happiest game I've ever played, and Nier Automata is the saddest video game I've ever played, so like the merger of those two things makes me very confused in my heart.
Because it's also that costume makes her look just like 2B.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
kind of eerie.
Yeah, but it's you know, I like the cross pollination of those studios. That works for me, but it is emotionally upsetting in some ways.
All right, Sean, your number 9.
My number 9, the little game that could, the game that is probably will feature in some way on my list next year once I have put 100 hours into it, is Hatsune Miku Project Diva Future Tone, the game that I literally did not even know existed a month ago, and didn't know that it came out, like, January, like, 7th or something this year. It came out at, like, barely squeaked into technically being eligible for this list. But Hatsune Miku Project Diva Future Tone is... I'll just like start off my thing with giving... It has 4 different special awards, which is the most of any awards I've given to a game, which is to recognize that I'm not done playing it yet. I'm in the middle of it, so it feels weird.
What do you define as finishing this game?
It's playing all of it, Jonathan.
Okay.
Playing all of it. And I'm yet.
Do you want to remind the people what this game is?
So, yes. Hatsune Miku Project Diva Future Tone, for those who don't know, and I can forgive you for not knowing, except for that means you have been listening to the last couple of weeks of podcasts from us. The Hatsune Miku Project Diva Future Tone is the PlayStation 4 home version of an arcade rhythm game called Hatsune Miku Project Diva Future Tone that compiles together... Like, I don't know exactly what it is. I'll look it up on Wikipedia while I'm talking about this. But it compiles together literally hundreds of different songs from Hatsune Miku, the virtual Vocaloid pop star from Japan, and all of her other Vocaloid friends, like Megarina Luka and those sorts of characters.
She has way more friends than I thought.
It's a lot, yeah. And it sort of brings all these songs together and takes advantage of what is like a really sort of like storied and advanced studio making these Project Diva games. That it's also the studio that made Persona 4 Dancing All Night and then the successful or succeeding Persona dancing games that are going to come in the future here. So it takes all the sort of like rhythm game mechanics that those games have kind of perfected, and the studio is so sort of studied at this point, and it just gives you access to this list of like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs. And it's also, like, it's packaged in a really friendly way as well, in that you can get You can buy the prelude version of it, which just gives you access to two songs. One of them is Weekender Girl, and the other one is 1/6 Out of the Gravity. Both of those are very good songs. I play both of those at this point. And then it gives you then you can buy separately two packs for about $30 each that give you access to a bunch of the other songs that are pulled from the other Project Diva games. Or you can just buy the full thing together for less than $60, and I got it for $30.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, so it is that leads to one of the special awards it gets is the most bang for your buck award, which I think is very appropriate because there's so many songs I'm actually having a hard time finding just like a number instead of just getting a huge list. But
I think it's 224.
Yes, yes,
or 240 something.
Yeah, it's in there. It's 200 something.
Because I was just looking at it yesterday, yeah. And so it has a little counter in the bottom.
Yeah, so it's something about 220 songs in it. Which is a lot of fucking songs for $30.
This is podcast 220 that we've done. So it has as many songs as we've done podcasts.
Yes, and how many years have we been doing this, John?
Six.
6 years. So that's, you could play one of these songs listening to our podcast from the last 6 years, and you'd finally run out of songs in this video game. And it's just, you know, it's an amazing game. It gives you such amazing value. But, like, really what it is I gave it this award, the I Really Needed This in 2017 Pure Joy Award.
Because I like that award.
Because that's just what it is. It was this incredible distraction for me when I was very busy, when shit was going on, and then when shit was going on in the political world, right? And it was just, I needed this thing that was both happy and poppy and colorful and earnest, and that's what Hatsune Miku is. It's just this, like, goofy J-pop ridiculous thing, and it's fucking ridiculous. The whole Hatsune Miku thing is one of the most ridiculous things that is happening in, like, popular culture in the world, and it's delightful because of that, because it is just absurd and happy and cheerful.
You said, I think, this on our Tuesday podcast this week, that, like, the wonderful thing about Hatsune Miku is that there's no irony in it. There's no cynicism in it. Like, it is the happiest version of a dystopian future we have in terms of where the robots take over. Yeah.
And that's what we need in 2017 because we're in one of the saddest versions of dystopia we can think of right now. But then also the version of gameplay it is of this, like, you know, really focused rhythm game of, like takes all these button presses to these, like, generally, like, really poppy, fast-paced J-pop songs. It allows you to really just sort of zone out, focus, get in tune with the music. I really love these kinds of rhythm games. I really love the last Project Diva game I played. I really love Dancing All Night. And I think there's something about it, and accompanied with the, like, incredible fucking music videos. The music videos are so fucking good. And I'm constantly, because, you know, I haven't probably even played through half of the songs in the game at this point. Because some of them I've played through multiple times on different difficulties. And I'm kind of now just going through each of the songs on hard. And it's taking me a while to get through all of that.
It's a hard game.
I mean, it has, like, that high skill ceiling, but it's something of that, you know, I really enjoy that because,
you know,
when I play Dancing All Night, I, with the exception of, I think, like, some of the DLC songs, which I just physically could not complete on the hardest difficulty, I did everything in that game on the hardest difficulty. I did everything in the last Project Diva game I did on the hardest difficulty. But, like, I'm not even, like, I can't play most of the songs on the hardest difficulty yet in this version because I'm rusty. And I'm still, like, building up those skills, building up that muscle memory, and then building up my familiarity with the songs. And that's one of the things I like about video games, that video games can provide as a form of entertainment, is even if it's not as, like, technically productive as learning a skill like carpentry or some bullshit, like, it is still feels like I'm exercising a skill, and I'm refining my motor skills, I'm refining this, like, talent at playing this game, and constantly and constantly and constantly and constantly getting better at it. I find that extremely satisfying. But the other thing, the real key that fucking locked this game onto the list is the most unexpected form of entertainment I've gotten this year, which is this game, for those who have not been listening to this podcast and me talking about this game, has what I call the best feature. It gets the best feature award for screenshots in the loading screen, which is that you can, instead of going and playing along with the music videos and playing the rhythm game, you can just go in and select to watch the music videos without any of the game component and just enjoy the music video and the music. And a lot of these music videos are very dramatic and sad, or they're very ridiculous and over the top. And you can, at any point, pause the music video. The one weakness is that you can't, like, rewind, so you have to be pretty proactive at pausing at the right moment and, like be on your shit, because if you miss that perfect shot, you can't go back. Which in some ways is almost better, because it's like you have to be an active participant. It's like real photography. You can't pause the world and rewind shit to get the perfect shot of this, like, tiger standing against, like, the Saharan background. Like, you have to get that shot perfect in that moment. You have to be there. So it's like you have to be present watching these music videos and pause and hit the triangle button and take screenshots, and then those screenshots get saved to your PlayStation 4 hard drive, where like your normal like share gallery screenshots are, and those then populate your loading screen. And so instead of getting like generic loading screen image of like a silhouette of like Hatsune Miku in blue with a bunch of bullshit in the background, it's Hatsune Miku standing next to a fake Godzilla and waving at the camera. It's Hatsune Miku staring dramatically outside of a window. But it's not just Hatsune Miku dramatically staring outside of a window, because the other thing about the game is that it has also, the fourth and final award I'm giving it is the Best Fashion Award, because this game has all these different modules you can buy and unlock to put on your different Vocaloid characters that like, for Miku has to have, like, well over 60 or 70. Like, she has a ridiculous number of outfits in the game, and all the characters have a bunch of outfits, and some of them are goofy and fun and cool, and legitimately, like, I think, like, the character designs are really cool, but specifically the winner, the person that is getting the award for the Best Fashion Award is Sonic Miku, which is Miku wearing Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas that say the word Sonic on the butt in big yellow letters, and she has big white gloves, and, like, her hood is up, and the hood has the spikes. It's the best fucking character design ever in anything ever. And so you can watch these music videos, and you can pause at any point, and you can take pictures of Miku, Hatsune Miku, wearing Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas, like staring dramatically outside of a window with a single tear rolling down her cheek. And I have taken a bunch, just a fucking bunch of these different screenshots, and I'm now going to share for you, Jonathan, and then I'm going to post a bunch of these on Twitter. But I just want, Jonathan, I want to show you some of my favorite of these screenshots.
Okay, let's do it.
So some of these, like, you've got, you know, the Godzilla one, which you've seen because you have this game, Jonathan.
Yes, and so. I actually have a screenshot very similar to that. And I should say our theme song today was the Godzilla Hatsune Miku song, Gigantic Girl, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. So that one's really good. I already posted before recording this podcast, there's two screenshots I put up on Twitter that are some of my dramatic Hatsune Miku screenshots. This is one from Weekender Girl that is just her waving at the camera, and it's really nice. It's just a nice little one, not very funny. This was one of my favorites. This is a screenshot of Hatsune Miku wearing the Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas, holding the earth floating in her hands, while chibi versions of the characters are standing around her and staring into the camera and smiling at you. And Hatsune Miku has this very solemn expression. I don't remember what the name of the song is. It's something to do like Hatsune Miku's this like goddess that lands on this planet, and then these little chibi robot versions of them have to sort of like bring the plant life of the planet back to life to resurrect this goddess Hatsune Miku. But instead of it being a goddess Hatsune Miku, it's Hatsune Miku wearing the Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas. And so that's very good. That's a really good screenshot. I like this one of just like Hatsune Miku with a very Mona Lisa-esque like mysterious expression staring into the
Hatsune
camera.
Hatsune Miku with a Mona Lisa-esque expression. I can assure you there is no other podcast that has produced that sentence.
Yes, it's very good. That's another thing of something I said on the podcast from Tuesday, the Star Wars one, is that the internet let us down. It let us fucking down that this game has been out for almost an entire year, and this has never been a thing. I never knew about it. I've never seen any of this shit. How has this not been the biggest thing on Twitter since forever? Because there's over 200 music videos. There's so many opportunities for great screenshots. And the other best thing about this that I discovered in some of the screenshots I'm about to show you, Jonathan, is that you can also buy these accessories that you can put on Hatsune Miku that's not just the Sonic outfit, that put like a funny mask on her face that has an angry like anime man expression and like masks and stuff like that. So now, Jonathan, you get to appreciate this screenshot, which is one of my personal favorites. I wish I could remember the name of the song. It's a like Japanese classical Japanese duet With you have, I forget, like one of the male, Kato, I think his name is, one of the male vocaloids in Hatsune Miku dancing together and doing this duet against the classical Japanese castle and doing a classic Japanese dance. And the male Hatsune Miku has a sword, that like a katana that he starts slashing, and the other one, the female one, starts dancing with a fan. And so I took a screenshot of that moment, but then properly sort of put the angry man expression on the samurai Hatsune Miku. So that one I think is very good.
And remember, they're all Sonic the Hedgehog in all of these.
Yes, they're all wearing Sonic the Hedgehog outfits, which is the best part. And then now I have a whole series of Hatsune Miku screenshots from the best music video I've seen so far, which is for the song called Love Hate, I think, or Hate Love, one of those. It's in that order. In those orders, which it has the two twins that have like the blonde hair sing together in this duet. But instead of having the blonde twins, you can replace both of them with Hatsune Miku wearing Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas. But then to properly differentiate the two of them, you have to put different things on them. So now you get to appreciate this, Jonathan, that the whole music video is expressed in graphic novel format, and they put a fun filter over the characters to kind of make them look like graphic novel characters with a bunch of manga sound effects and stuff. So I just took a bunch of these, and they're all really good. Here you get, because the song is about these two characters being in love, which is kind of weird because the actual ones that are singing the song are supposed to be twins. Don't read too much into that. But there's one part in the music video where the lady one goes to pick up this teddy bear and then sees the image of this man she loves in the face of the teddy bear superimposed on it. But instead of it being the face of the man she loves, it's the face of Hatsune Miku wearing this ridiculous mask with angry eyes on it. And so that's really fucking good. It also has the Japanese word hentai, which means pervert, right next to it. So if you can read Japanese, it has...
I was going to ask you about that. I was like, does that say hentai, Sean?
It does. So it holds a whole other layer of meaning if you've done the work and can read Japanese. There's a couple of other ones. Here's Hatsune Miku dressed as Sonic trying to kiss a teddy bear. And then here's them taking pictures together of like they're at a photo booth. And so then I just have a couple of these of them doing these fun poses. So there's that one. Here's them making a heart together. Again, all dressed as Sonic the Hedgehog with funny things on. And again, I will post all of these on my Twitter around the time this podcast goes up. So if you want to see them, that's where you go to see them. And then this is the last one, which is just all those screenshots put together from the end of the music video.
My biggest takeaway from all this, Sean, the last 5 minutes we've spent looking at all these pictures. I once tried to show you pictures of my newborn niece, and you made fun of me.
This is so much better than that. This is so much like, I get like, you know, your niece is probably amazing, and it's a whole human life and all this stuff. She's not Hatsune Miku wearing Sonic the Hedgehog pajamas, so...
This is only your number 9, I'm surprised.
This is only, again, I'm going to talk about this game on Game of the Year next year for sure, because I am not fucking done playing this game. I'm probably not halfway through the songs on the game, but I broke my own personal rule of not putting a game on the list that I haven't finished yet, specifically for this game, because I knew it would have to be on the list.
Alright, so can we move on?
Yes, we can move on.
All right. No, I love how much you love Hatsune Miku.
You will love her just as much. You're just not there yet.
My number 9 game of the year is in some ways the most surprising game of the year in terms of its quality, but it really shouldn't have been, and that is Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle for the Nintendo Switch, developed by Ubisoft. It is surprising because if you just told a random person on the street, including me, they're making a Mario plus Rabbids game, what's that going to be like? You'd probably say, that sounds dumb.
Yeah, and I think we did.
Yeah, we did, yeah. But here's the thing. Mario, for every like mainline platformer Mario game, he's starred in like at least 10 different spin-offs, all in a completely different genre, and more of them are enjoyable than not. Like, when Mario goes afield, it tends to work. It especially works when he goes afield with RPGs. And I would say Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle is a Mario RPG on par with Mario RPG for the SNES, Paper Mario for the N64, Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga for the Game Boy Advance, all of those, like, landmark Mario RPG titles. For whatever reason, when Mario plays around with RPG shit, he does a good job.
That's true.
The weird X factor here was the Rabbids... And they're a completely enjoyable part of the game. And they're very funny. And the game is very fun to play because it's got a nice little story. This is one of the games I would refer to as, like, not heavily narrative. It has a narrative going on, but, like, obviously that's not the focus of the game. Although it does have very fun writing. I think I talked about this on the podcast before. This has easily my favorite version of Bowser Jr. in Mario franchise history. He steals the show. He is so funny in this, just as, like, kind of a lame little bully kid who's afraid of his dad. It's very, very funny. I love the whole presentation of the game, and the rabbits do add a lot of light little humor, and they're definitely not overused to the degree where they would just become like, you know, the Minions spin-off movie of Despicable Me. They're more like the Minions in Despicable Me, where they fucking belong, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, but all of that is married to what is a genuinely really, really good RPG game. And that's the similarity this has, more than anything, with other Mario RPGs, where they didn't pull any punches in building an actual RPG game system. In this case, we got a tactical RPG, which is one of my favorite genres. The tactical combat in this game is sort of reminiscent of the XCOM series, but it's all very streamlined, where you only have three units on the field at once, you always have to have Mario with you, and then choose two other from your party. And there's kind of a limited number of sort of weapon types and a limited number of skill types, and it's very much for me a less is more kind of thing, because tactical RPGs are, like many RPGs, want to, shall we say, overstuffing their games with customization and weapons and classes and all those different things, and sometimes that can be absolutely wonderful, but the game can get buried in that on occasion, I think. And one of the things I really liked about the design of Kingdom Battle is that it's so streamlined and focused that it's like an easy to learn, hard to master kind of thing. And that also allows the very, very talented developers at Ubisoft Paris and Milan, is where this was developed. You always have to look and check which European or Canadian city was it made in.
Yes, which Ubisoft was this Ubisoft?
Yes. But the very talented team, because it is such a streamlined game, they can put so much effort into the actual, like, combat maps and the combat arenas. And just about every tactical match you get into this game is interesting in one way or another. There's four overall worlds to explore. The first two worlds are easier, and I still think the combat is very good and entertaining, but they're still kind of just ratcheting everything up. Worlds 3 and 4 are some of the best tactical RPG stuff I have ever played. It truly taxes your mind, truly taxes your sense of strategy. And again, because it's so focused on this small set of fundamentals, I think it can weirdly go out on like a bigger limb a lot of the time in how it designs combat scenarios than other tactical RPGs I love. And so all of that made it a real revelation to me. I played, you know, this game probably took 30-ish hours to complete. I loved every minute of it. If there were more time in the year, I would have gone back and done all the, like, 100% completion stuff where you go back through the worlds.
Right.
There's all these different challenges. It's a very, like most Ubisoft games, you get your money's worth. They put a lot into it. But what a treat. What another just feather in the cap of the Nintendo Switch for its first year. Totally unexpected, even if, again, maybe it shouldn't be, because Mario tends to be pretty good at this kind of thing. And just a game I really loved. And when you bring all of these elements together, the, you know, combat design and the gameplay design and the crazy aesthetics and the crazy music, which was by Grant Kirkhope, great video game composer, you get a scene like the World 3 boss with the opera-singing Phantom Rabbit, which is riotously funny and an ingeniously designed combat encounter. And there are moments like that where this was just as pure an enjoyment of any game in 2017 as I had. Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle is the real deal. It's not a lark. It is a great game in its own right, and I hope we get more of these. And I also think it points to an interesting future where Nintendo is willing to open up some of their properties to other talented developers, because Ubisoft clearly took this thing seriously. It was clearly a labor of love for them. And if you can get more of those kinds of things, and people taking Mario and, you know, Zelda and other kinds of characters and doing interesting, fun things with them, I think that's a cool idea. And I like what Nintendo did here. And if you own a Nintendo Switch, you should own this game.
Yeah, it is like the most surprising good game this year.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, again, the Kingdom Battle part of it, we probably should have expected that'd be fine. The Mario plus Rabbids part of it scared a lot of people off, and don't let it. It's the Rabbids, I think. I don't know anything about the Rabbids. Frankly, I didn't know if they were just like the video game versions of the Minions or something. I didn't know who they were.
I mean, they technically predate the Minions.
Yeah.
So more of the Minions are the movie versions of the Rabbids.
But I honestly had to look up, like, have they been in games before? Are they for marketing? What the hell are they? You don't need to know anything about them. They're just funny little rabbit creatures that, like, wear Mario costumes in this game. And it's good. It's just good.
I remember back when the Rabbids were Rayman like sub characters. Now how far they've flown. Now nobody even remembers. It was Rayman back in the day.
Rayman did not get a Kingdom Battle game this year.
No. He should have, though. That should have been the last boss. Like, the secret last boss is Rayman, who's just, like angry because nobody bought, like, the two 2D games they made, like, Origins and Legends a couple of years ago.
Which were apparently good, but...
They're supposed to be good. I never got around to them. It's just like, fuckers, like, why can't I just, like, make more of my games?
I think I've gotten Rabbit Rayman...
Rabbit pieces of shit.
I think I've gotten Rayman Legends for free on, like, four different consoles.
It came out on everything. Yeah.
But, like, literally, like, it's in PS Plus, Xbox Live Gold. I think they gave it away on the Wii U at one point. It's nuts.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my number 9, so we're going back to you, Sean, for your number 8.
My number 8 game of the year is Sonic Mania, which is I guess, like, the first thing I will say is it got my C, This Can Be Good award, which is, you fuckers, like, Sega, you can get a good Sonic the Hedgehog game out there. I'm not going to say that you can make a good Sonic the Hedgehog game, because you did Generations, like, in 2012, and you did Sonic Forces this year, which I didn't play. You played, Jonathan.
Not good.
Yeah, not good. Based on everyone's opinion, Sonic Forces is not good.
Not necessarily bad, but not good.
So Sega can't make a really good Sonic the Hedgehog game, but there are people who can do it. And luckily, Sega decided, well, let's get the people who can make good Sonic the Hedgehog games to make a good fucking Sonic the Hedgehog game. And guess what they did? They made a really, really fucking good Sonic the Hedgehog game. Sonic Mania is just an utter fucking joy to play. Like, it looks amazing because it looks... You know, it's that sort of, you know, classic thing of it looks the way you remember Sonic the Hedgehog looking. It evokes so much of the spirit and style and tone and heart of Sonic the Hedgehog in those classic 16-bit Sega Genesis Sonic the Hedgehog games, like 1 through Knuckles. And it evokes that art style, but it can do so much more. It's got so many fucking frames of animation, and it looks so good. And the music is just brilliant, because the music does all those things as well, especially with the classic stages that have, you know, the first zone will play, or the first act of a classic zone will play a more traditional version of those themes, and then the second act will remix them and do crazy shit. It has some of the best bosses in any video game, you know, especially like in Sonic the Hedgehog history, and like some of the most interesting, innovative, creative fucking bosses I've played in a platformer game like that. And it takes such great advantage of the whole history of Sonic the Hedgehog, down to having you fight the weird characters like Bean the Dynamite, or whatever the fuck his name is, and the three guys from Sonic Fighters, which are like weird boss characters in the Mirage Saloon Zone. And just... As someone who is a massive fan of Sonic the Hedgehog, and particularly of the Sega Genesis games, which are the games that I grew up on, Sonic Mania does so much to, like, reimagine and re-embolden that classic Sonic the Hedgehog design, which has been so spoiled for years by Sega not understanding what the fuck to do with their, like, marquee franchise character and their marquee franchise games. And Sonic Mania just expresses all that so brilliantly and perfectly. And, like, the only reason that it's not higher on this list is that I haven't had enough time to play it as much as I would like, because I've only beaten it 3 times or something, which is, for a classic Sonic game, like, that's not that much time. Like, that's a couple of hours, really. And I'm, like, this is a game that I'm definitely, like, in the winter going to go back to, like... I say it with, like, fucking January is huge this year. So maybe sometime next summer, at some point I'm going to come back to Sonic Mania, and because I never even beat, like, a Knuckles run, you know? Like, I haven't... There's some stuff in this game I really want to be able to do that I haven't been able to do yet because it came out in the fall and I was just too busy. But, yeah, it's just brilliant. The other award it gets is the Best Sonic Award, which is a tie between Sonic Mania and Sonic Miku from Hatsune Miku. So Hatsune Miku's game technically got 5 extra awards because it also ties with Best Sonic.
Hatsune Miku should just be your number 1, Sean. I mean, all the metrics are pointing there.
I mean, you haven't heard what's higher up on this list for me. I know. Yeah, Sonic Mania is just awesome.
Sonic Mania is higher on my list.
I imagined it was.
Yeah, I actually thought it was going to be higher on yours, but that's interesting. Yeah.
Again, I think it probably would be if I had more time to play it.
Yeah, and I really fell for that one. I will tell you where it is in a minute. Number 8 is one we've already talked about, and that is Uncharted: The Lost Legacy is my number 8 for the year. you know, last year's Uncharted 4 was, to my mind, not just a masterpiece, but maybe a game that was underrated by the larger gaming community.
I think it definitely was.
Because I think got overshadowed by some other games that were, in their own ways, kind of newer, fresher, shinier, like Doom or something like that. Even though Doom is also, you know, based on a 30-year-old property. But Uncharted 4, I think, you know, is Naughty Dog, the kinds of games Naughty Dog makes, nobody else makes, at least to that degree. Like, the closest you can come is, like, the Crystal Dynamics Tomb Raider games, and I love those games. They don't quite hold a candle to what Naughty Dog does, you know? It's like the imitation champagne versus the real deal from, like, Champagne, France or something like that.
Right.
But Uncharted 4 was just so great, but it was also so deliberately and reflexively unending, a punctuation note to that series, a culmination to everything that series did in terms of puzzles and platforming and shooting. And so when Uncharted The Lost Legacy was announced and we saw the previews, and even by the time, you know, I bought the game, I always felt kind of split. Like, not like I was dreading it. I was eager to play another Uncharted game. I love Uncharted. But I was really curious if there was enough gas left in the tank to support another one of these.
Yeah.
And by the end of my 8 hours playing through this campaign, I never wanted Uncharted to end. And I don't know if I can think of a comparable thing like that, where I thought a series was pretty much over, and then I played another one and I'm like, oh God, I never want this to go away. And Uncharted The Lost Legacy is just that good. It is so fully and completely invigorated. You know, it gets all the good stuff Uncharted 4 had. It has that great, tight, energetic combat system. But above and beyond all of that, The Lost Legacy features, and here's my list, the greatest and most creatively complicated puzzles in the entire series.
Yeah.
The puzzles are so good. I think it has the best extended climbing slash platforming sequence in any Uncharted game, and that's when you're climbing through the Lost City in the middle of the game. It has an amazing open world chapter that is a complete breakthrough for Naughty Dog, and I think a potential glimpse into what the future of this genre could look like. An incredible finale on a train, as we often do in Uncharted, that provides the series with, I think, its finest action climax to date, easily.
Yeah.
Blending, you know, some real challenge with some immersive cinematic thrills. It's got another terrific score from Henry Jackman, a Hollywood composer who joined the series with Uncharted 4. And of course, maybe most importantly, it's got an outstanding lead in Chloe Frazier, who makes the jump from supporting character to playable protagonist with aplomb. Beautiful, magnificent performance from Claudia Black. She is just such a star in this game, and born to be a star, and buoyed by a perfectly calibrated sidekick in Laura Bailey's Nadine Ross. I think Chloe is every bit as compelling a protagonist as Nathan Drake. And even if the gameplay environment's puzzles weren't so accomplished, and they are accomplished here, I think she alone would make this feel like a fresh second act for Uncharted. It all adds up to a game that I think feels so much more vital and refreshing than the fifth game in any series has any right to be.
Right.
Like, you know, compare this to, like, Halo 5. You know, another series. Halo's a little older than Uncharted, but comparable.
Yeah.
And that series feels like a dead series walking. Uncharted is just getting better and better and better. And I completely understand if Naughty Dog says internally, like, we've made a lot of Uncharted games. It's time to step away. It's time to do new things. I get that, and I don't hold anything against them. At the same time, Naughty Dog, stop everything else you're doing and make more Uncharted games, because this is so good. You've got this perfect new protagonist. Just, like, spin off a little team and make more Uncharted games, maybe every 2 or 3 years. I would love that. I think you are absolutely right, Sean, in what you said about the business model this game hits upon. I think it is just a brilliant accomplishment. And, you know, more than maybe at any point in the life of the franchise, Uncharted feels like it's immortal to me. And it could just keep going and going. And there are very few franchises you can say that about. Because a lot of franchises, like the one you just talked about, Sonic, kind of have to prove themselves over and over again. Uncharted is 5 A or A plus games in a row. And there's a weird Vita one somewhere in there, but we don't count that.
We definitely do not count that. I played the first 10 minutes of that game, and then I did not want to play anymore.
I did too. It was bad. Uncharted The Lost Legacy is not bad. It's one of the best games of the year, and I wish I were playing it right now.
Yes, me too. We are both on agreement. That game is fucking awesome and deserves to be top 10 game of the year.
Yep. You're number 7.
My number 7 game of the year is Horizon Zero Dawn. From way back 5,000 years ago, February 2017, it seems so long ago, Jonathan, that I played through this game. And it was one that, like, this is one of the ones I had the hardest time figuring out what to do with on this list. because it had been long enough that I had played it, and I had played so many games since then, and it wasn't, like, this game is not, like, automatically, like vying for the top, but it's, like, so good that it felt like it needs to be on my top 10. Luckily, they put out an expansion very recently that I was like, oh, this is a good opportunity. I haven't gotten super deep into that expansion, but it was just enough, like, okay, this is a good excuse to jump back into this world, and that reminded me of why I like this game so much, is that I love the world, I love the setting, and particularly I love the character Aloy, who is your protagonist character, and just the vibe of the story in this game, and the combat flow, and the sort of the larger sort of like game routine and rotation that you go through, of this sort of vaguely monster, now I can say vaguely Monster Hunter-esque, because I've played some Monster Hunter now, but this sort of like, you know, going out and fighting these just incredible gigantic robot dinosaur monsters, and hunting them for their parts, and engaging in these just ridiculous, amazing fucking battles. Some of the best combat in any game this year, other than there's one game that has a better combat system that you might hear from my list shortly, but for especially for an open world like game with RPG mechanics and like a narrative focus like this, I tend to set my expectations of how like a combat in a game like this is going to go relatively low. You know, I'm not going into Skyrim expecting the combat mechanics to be amazing. Like, I didn't like, you know, like Legend of Zelda, the combat didn't do it for me in that game this year, but Horizon Zero Dawn, like, one of the big things that kept me coming back to that game was not just the story and characters, but was how engaging the combat was and how much I felt like how rewarding and creative it was to, especially playing it on the harder difficulties, needing to make use of this wide range of tools that are available to you and take advantage of the weaknesses of the enemies, get to learn the movements and archetypes of the enemies and take advantage of that with all the different weapon types you have. And then I gave this game two special awards. One, which is the biggest one for me, is I give it the most young adult award, which is because this game does something that no other game I've played honestly has quite done, which is you are playing a young adult book. Like, that is, it is, and I am not the first person to make this point. On Waypoint, there is a article by Alex Meehan called Horizon Zero Dawn is the Young Adult Novel I've Always Wanted to Play. And one thing that I don't think I ever talked about on this podcast, but over this summer, because I've been taking these classes to get a teacher's license, one of the classes I took was a class on young adult literature. That's obviously useful if you're going to teach high school students, because they're young adults. They probably read young adult literature. I don't know what high school students do these days.
They just read Twitter.
Yes.
No, you know what? No, we read Twitter. We're old.
Yes.
They read Snapchat.
They read Snapchat and Instagram. I've spent an unfortunate amount of time with 12-year-olds recently. They're not. They don't even know what a Twitter is anymore. I don't know if they can read yet. But, Horizon Zero Dawn evokes this quality of young adult literature that's so hard to grasp onto, but it's specifically, like, Aloy as this main protagonist who's this young woman who's just, like, is making her way out in the world. And it is one of those really refreshing things if you just don't have female protagonists in video games very much. Like, that's one of the things that was really refreshing about The Lost Legacy. But also, that was a character in, like, two characters that we already knew and were set up from other games. And Aloy is this really fresh new character that just embodies this spirit that is sort of like Rey from the new Star Wars movies. It's a similar sort of character. And it's just fresh and interesting, and it's optimistic and earnest in a way that young adult literature is. And it's not, you know, this is not the best story of the year. Like, there are exactly five games on my list that were, or I guess if you include Uncharted Lost Legacy, there are six games. And if you include the narratives behind my screenshots in Hatsune Miku, there are seven games on the list that have better stories than Horizon Zero Dawn. But it's not, that the point is not that it's good, or like it's the best. The point is that it's enjoyable, and it's tremendously enjoyable, and it's that kind of like popcorn story that you would expect video games to be very good at doing, but they're usually not very good at doing. And like Naughty Dog is actually one of the other developers that's like very good at doing that, but in a slightly different way, because this isn't just an action story. It's also about building up and fleshing out this really rich setting of this post-apocalyptic future of the Earth has been destroyed. Humans are reverted to predominantly tribal-based cultures. They've lost access to most of their technology and science and sort of like philosophy and history. Like the fall of Rome happened basically, and also the world is inhabited by giant robot dinosaur monsters that you don't really at the start of the game don't understand why the world has gotten to that state. But over the course of the story delivers a really compelling, interesting, unique, and surprising answer to that question of why is the world in the state it is in. And that's, you know, I think that it's just a remarkable game all around that is incredibly fresh which then gives it, the last thing I'll say about this game is I give it the Watch Them Soar Award, which I'm giving to Guerrilla Games because they have been let loose from the chains of Killzone, a franchise that, like, is okay, but was clearly not what the studio was built to do.
It's a franchise that will not make it into the history books.
Yes, it's like, I enjoyed quite a bit the campaigns to Killzone 2 and 3, and I thought Shadowfall had a decent campaign for a launch game, but, like, that franchise was enjoyable while you play it and completely forgettable when you're not. But, yeah, this game feels like, and then obviously, like, the games they're going to make in the future in this Lou, if this feels like what the Guerrilla Games studio has been wanting to do for so long, and they're so talented. The other thing is, this game is just fucking drop-dead gorgeous, like, at every single second. It is, because it's not just, like, the photorealism, there is a style to it, there's an art style to it, and there's, you know, the colors and the density of the foliage and those sorts of things, that it's the most technically accomplished game on my list by far. And I'm just very, very pleased that Guerrilla Games got to make their own franchise, their own IP, because we are very deep into this generation of video game consoles, and there are not a lot of new IPs that have come out from AAA developers, and I'm happy that Horizon Zero Dawn is the one that we got, because it's very fucking good.
This was the game on the tip of my tongue earlier when we were talking about, like, regrets that we didn't get to.
Yeah.
This is my far and away biggest regret of 2017, as at least for games, not, like, in life.
Yes. There's a lot more of those.
Yes. No, for games is that I did not get around to Horizon Zero Dawn. I actually do own this game. I've booted it up and played, like, 5 to 10 minutes of it and just was like, you know what, I'm not ready to commit to this right now. And I wish I would have had the time to play it. I was trying to support, like, 2.5, depending on how you define the 3DS, game libraries this year.
Right.
And this was the casualty of all of that. It looks great. I love the passion it has inspired in everyone who's played it. And I agree with you completely. You don't even have to play the game to give them the Watch Them Soar Award.
Yeah.
It's so cool Guerrilla Games got to do this. It feels like it's emboldened Sony to let, what's the studio that makes Infamous?
Sucker Punch.
Sucker Punch. They've been let free to make their Ghosts of Tsushima game.
Tsushima.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just so cool. It's one of the first new real, you know, IPs we've had this generation. All of that is very neat to me. And I just love that this game exists, and hopefully one day I will have the time to play it.
I'll also say, like before we let you move on to your interview and your list, is that the background image on my PlayStation 4 is still this screenshot I took in the game of the full moon over this lake that is just gorgeous to me. It's been that forever. Now that I'm thinking about it, I might change it to an image of Sonic Miku. I don't know. But, like, it's been that for, like, a year has been this screenshot I took in that game. So that's, you know, that's how beautiful that game is to me.
That was your number 7. My number 7 is another one you already talked about. Sonic Mania. We all had Sonic Mania this year.
Yes, we did.
Sometimes for the wrong reasons if you played Sonic Forces.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of where I want to start. This year was a tale of two Sonics for that series.
Because that's what they should put on the back of the box for the year 2017, the tale of two Sonics.
Because on one hand, you had the Sonic game that Sega made, that they poured millions of dollars in, that they had the big hype campaign for, that, like, their best Sonic team developers worked on, and it was a dud. Again, I won't even call Sonic Forces a bad game. It would be so much more interesting if it were a bad game. It's just there. And you can play it if you want. You probably shouldn't. I traded mine in to buy Hatsune Miku. I got trade-in value and bought a PSN card with it on Amazon. So that's what Sonic Forces did for me. I got a better Sonic game.
Yeah, you traded up Sonics. Like, yes, again, yes. Hatsune Miku's tied for best Sonic of 2017, my friend.
But Sonic Forces is so defining of Sega and their franchise and how they are like a neglect parent. They do not know how to do this, and somehow they have been raising this child for years without intervention. But over here on Sonic Mania, they let the child go stay at a friend's house for a day. And those friends loved that child and cared for that child and made that child the best version of itself for a glorious, glorious time. And that is Sonic Mania. Sonic Mania, I think, is truly kind of without precedent in the history of games in that it is basically just Sega handing over some money and technology to fan developers, you know?
Yeah.
Christian Whitehead, one of the three developers on this, has you know, a little more experience in the industry because he was brought up already to do the iOS ports of the Sonic games, which they really need to get on consoles for That yes, would be cool, yeah. But anyway, so, you know, he was kind of already in the door, but Christian Whitehead, Headcanon, and Pagoda West Games, the other two had made, like, Sonic fan games, independent HD remasters, you know, these are people who really, like, love and adore, and most importantly, know Sonic, and Sega has not known what Sonic, you know, what makes Sonic work for a very long time. And even when it feels like they know what, you know, works, like with a Sonic Generations, it's clearly an aberration because it's not part of a pattern. And so they gave it off to the fans. Very small team made this game. It's an obvious labor of love. You already talked about this, but those graphics are so gorgeous. That music is so stellar. And more than anything else, there is such tremendous skill and creativity put into making this game. These are not just like fans fucking around with Sonic remixes. These are great video game developers making a great 2D platforming video game. There's never really been a 2D platforming series like original Sonic the Hedgehog,
yeah.
And there probably never will be another thing like it, but you can make more good Sonic games, and that's what they've done here. Sonic Mania is the best of everything you loved about those Sonic the Hedgehog Genesis games, but it plays even better. The level design is even more bold and creative. You know, the visuals and the soundtracks are even better. It's just a phenomenal game, and I think pound for pound, it is as, you know, well-designed a platformer as you could go find right now in general. It is a real, you know, work of art, and I love it. And if Sega has any sense in the world, they will have already commissioned a sequel to this game in secret. And yes, someone will be working on it, and they will make more of these, and Sega will just close up shop for Sonic Team at their actual studio because they don't know what they're doing, and this child will get to go live with the friends, and it will be the happy ending.
Yes, we need Sonic the Hedgehog to be adopted at some point.
We
that's,
do.
That's where we're at.
We do, because Sega don't know what they're doing, but at least they made the right choice in, again, giving it to the friends for a weekend. I should also note, Sonic Mania is the only multi-platform game on my list.
Yeah, it's one of the two on my list.
Which... what a fucking year.
Yeah.
I will say, and I also played this one on the Nintendo Switch, one of the several games on this list, and now that they have fixed the one weird glitch where it went to the home screen slow, Sonic Mania on Switch was one of my favorite things on Switch this year. Part of why I played this game so much, because I did a full campaign with Sonic, a full campaign with Tails, I've done a bunch of it with Knuckles, and I've gone back in and played a bunch of other levels, is it's just really fun, like, just to pull it out and play a couple of levels on the Switch, on the, you know, the handheld screen. It looks fucking gorgeous on there, and it plays so beautifully. So if you own a Switch and have not played Sonic Mania, I think that's the platform to get it for.
Yeah.
That's Sonic Mania. That's my number 7, so we're on to number 6.
My number 6 is Nioh, which is just this fucking game, Jonathan. I guess the easiest way to start the conversation is to give it my award. The Akira Kurosawa Presents Best Action Award goes to Nioh, which is both because it's got the best combat in any game I played this year, and in any game I played in a while, since probably Bloodborne for me. And then also, like, that action is fucking amazing, awesome samurai action that they clearly pulled a lot of inspiration from several different Akira Kurosawa movies. Like, there are a couple of spear moves that are clearly inspired from the spear fight from Hidden Fortress, which is the Kurosawa film. But then also I give it specifically this award because Nioh was fucking robbed at the Game Awards because they gave Best Action Game to Wolfenstein 2: The New Colossus, which is a fantastic game, but the combat in that game doesn't even fucking touch the combat in Nioh. So Nioh gets my Akira Kurosawa Presents Best Action Award because this fucking game. Like, I basically played this game for like a month and a half, and the only bad thing about the game really is that there's too much of it. Like, it just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes, which is, of all the issues to have, that's probably the best one you can have. But the thing about Nioh is that it has, like, one of the best settings you can have in a game. You know, it's set in Sengoku-era Japan, but with, like, demons and monsters pulled from Japanese folklore, and you are playing William Adams, who is this historic Englishman who washed up in Japan and ended up, you know, serving alongside, under Tokugawa Ieyasu and the Tokugawa Shogunate, and they made the smart choice of changing him to be Irish in this one, just to, like, more make the game for me. And it is just... you know, it has this nice, light, very sort of, like, fun story where you go and meet all these sort of historical figures. You meet Tokugawa Ieyasu, you meet Hanzo Hattori, you even get to meet Oda Nobunaga through, like, sort of story stuff, because he's technically dead by this time in the story. But if you're, like, kind of a history nerd for this era of Japanese history, which I am, like, that part of the game is very rewarding, and that part of the game is a lot of fucking fun. Because it's goofy in all the right ways, and it's serious in all the right ways, and it has good interpretations, I think, of all the historical figures. But more than anything else, it is about the combat in this game is just fucking sublime. It is, you are, like, everything I said about Hatsune Miku and playing those games is like you're learning a skill. Like, that it is that, but ratcheted up by 1,000, that you, there are so many different techniques and, you know, across all the different weapon types that you can learn, and so many different ways that you can put your skills together in combination with the different enemies you're fighting, particularly when you get into the boss fights, that it is one of the most sort of, like, complicated and nuanced combat systems I've ever engaged with in a video game. And the sense of mastering that over the course of this game while you're progressing through harder and harder enemies, harder and harder missions, and they're constantly throwing you at you challenges that you think you can't accomplish, and then when you take a step back and reconsider everything you have access to, you know that, like, fuck it, I can do this. Even when you get into the end game and they start throwing two bosses at you at the same time, you're like, there's no way to do this. But there is. Like, you can do this if you put your mind to it and you really sort of, like, dedicate yourself to mastering the combat system of this game. It just feels incredible. You know, the timing is so sharp. It's got a really solid 60 frames per second frame rate. If you pick the... It allows you to pick action mode and cinematic mode. Pick action mode so you get the higher frame rate, because that's... You really need that for this game. And then it, the other thing of this game is it gets my coolest shit award, which is goes specifically to the wiping the blood off of your sword and sheathing it animation, because it seems like it should be so basic that video games would deliver on this, like, samurai fantasy, especially when you consider, like, the history of Japan in video games. But the truth is that for, like, the past 10 years or so, Japan hasn't made a lot of games like this. And the ones that they have made have not come over here. At some point, I'm going to play Yakuza Ishin in Japanese, but that's going to be a 100-hour game that takes even longer to play in Japanese. So it's like, there are some games that do this that are out there, but not many, and even fewer in English. And Neo just executes on that fantasy at such a high fucking level, at both being an excellent video game and, I think, an excellent power fantasy that is the kind of power fantasy that I want to have, which is running around feudal Japan and chopping up fucking Tengu with your cool katana and then swiping the blood off your sword and sheathing it in a really cool way, and that's just fucking rad. Like, that's the thing about this game. This game is fucking rad as shit. It also gets, I'm declaring now, I'm typing it in, gets the rad as shit award to Neo, officially awarded. Jonathan, you can see,
added it to the record. Yes. It's not the fucking rad as shit award?
No, just rad as shit award. It's fucking awesome. Neo's awesome. People should play it. It's very good.
Speaking of good games, no, that's the, we can do that with every
one of these. Yeah, we should use that to segue every single time.
Yeah, no. Also a Japanese game. I think we're going to be talking about a lot of Japanese games.
Yeah.
Especially from here on out. This is also where I think our lists are going to start diverging, Sean.
Probably.
My number six is Fire Emblem Echoes, Shadows of Valentia for the Nintendo 3DS. The Nintendo 3DS had a really fascinating year in 2017. It was obviously overshadowed by the launch of the Nintendo Switch, which was a bigger success and did better in terms of what games it put on the market than I think anyone could have really predicted, including those at Nintendo. But in the meantime, the Nintendo 3DS was over here in the corner and played home to at least two, by my count, because there's another 3DS game coming, of the year's most compelling games. And both of these games, by an interesting stroke of coincidence, made huge new strides for their respective long-running franchises by revisiting Black Sheep sequels from the past. And so for Fire Emblem Echoes, it would be, I think, a great disservice to call a remake of 1992's Fire Emblem Gaiden for the Famicom. Gaiden is one of the many early Fire Emblem games that never came out over here, yeah, or indeed outside of Japan at all. So Echoes, just on that level, was a really cool thing to hear about at the beginning of this year, because this was announced like 2 months before it came out, and they had remade one of these early Fire Emblem games, and so people around the world would finally get to play this thing. But when you actually sit down and play Echoes, it's clear this is so much more than a remake. It inherits some things from its Famicom ancestor. It's got an engaging central premise. The pair of protagonists, Alm and Celica, are great. And it takes a lot of the great musical compositions from that era and redoes them. But I think what it gets most from looking to the past and saying, let's look at this weird... Because Gaiden, when it came out, was a weird sequel to Fire Emblem. It's like Zelda 2 or something, where it wasn't quite like the first game, or Final Fantasy 2, any of those famous 2s from the Famicom era. And I think what it gets most from looking to that point in the past is a refreshing sense of freedom from 25 years of franchise formula and familiarity. And I say this as someone who loves Fire Emblem. I've loved the recent 3DS Fire Emblem games. Those are the games that made me a Fire Emblem fan. But I think this game, without having some longtime series staples, like it does away with the weapon triangle, it does away with the more recent things like the bonding system and the support conversations, and without those things, it's free to invent in new directions. And I think it has a lot of really invigorating experimentations. Like, it has fully roamable dungeons where you have, like, random encounters, not random encounters because it's enemies on the map you hit, but you have encounters with people in the Fire Emblem battle system. So there's these, like, randomly generated little Fire Emblem battles you have. And there's these first-person segments in towns and castles that almost feel like, you know, PC adventure games from the 1990s, like the best parts of those games. And those had this great sense of atmosphere and immersion. And meanwhile, the fundamentals, because they really get to focus on this, are so good. The tactical combat encounters are the real deal. I think they're some of the most creative and challenging I've ever played in a Fire Emblem game. You know, when I talked about... some, you know, tactical games can maybe get a little overwhelmed when I was talking about Mario plus Rabbids. I would say that about something like maybe a Fire Emblem Fates. Fire Emblem Echoes is just the real deal. It is so good as, like, here are your units. We're not messing about with 100 different classes, and we're not messing about with even little things like the weapons triangle. It's much more of a traditional RPG about stats, but that means it's this basic thing where they can really focus on that combat design, and it is a series of just remarkable, amazing maps. Really reminds me of, like, the early Game Boy Advance Fire Emblem games we got over here, and just how tight those are as, like, tactical RPGs. And so you have this great game to play, and underlying all of it is, I think, easily the best Fire Emblem story I've ever seen. Like, maybe Awakening would be 1A or number 2, and Awakening is great, but I think Fire Emblem Echoes is even better. It's got this great cast of characters. The presentation is some of the best I've ever seen in a JRPG. We might talk about a certain game later that rhymes with Bearsona. And it's like on par with that in terms of just general presentation of its story. The art direction and graphics are first rate. Another miraculous achievement for the 3DS at this point in its life cycle. Stellar writing. And most importantly, because I didn't think I needed this from Fire Emblem, but once you play it, it's hard to go back. Incredible voice acting. Because Fire Emblem has never had a fully voiced game. It's never even really had a game with any significant voice acting presence. But this game is completely 100%, other than, like, little tiny things here and there, voice acted. And the cast is just fantastic. Also shares a lot of actors with a game that rhymes with Bearsona that we'll get to later. And I just think that the central tale of Almond Celica, it's not just good, but it's surprisingly rich in the cultural background they build out, in thematic nuance. And it all builds to what I talked about back over the summer. One of the best uses of the traditional let's fight a god trope I've ever seen in the JRPG genre. And that is a fucking trope.
Yes,
so
it is, yeah.
When something like that can feel new and, like, thematically integral to the story, that's a really interesting thing. Simply put, this is perhaps my favorite entry in one of my favorite franchises. It offers one of my all-time favorite consoles, one of its very best titles. And 2017 is so insanely stacked that it only comes in at number 6. Because this year is fucking nuts.
Yes, it is.
So that is my number 6, Fire Emblem Echoes. Don't underestimate this one. You should play it.
All right.
I saw fucking... just let me dunk on Polygon one more time in the year 2017.
Okay, yes. Because I like it's to the last this. Opportunity you have.
They put out, like, you know, they had their normal, like, top 10 list, and fine. Maybe not the list I would have made, but it's fine. It's a good list. And then they did, like, it ranked out to 50. The only Fire Emblem game they had in their top 50 this year was the fucking mobile one.
Fire Emblem Heroes?
Yeah, the gacha game. And it's like, one, that game is morally dubious. And two, you had a real Fire Emblem game in Fire Emblem Echoes and a really good spinoff in Fire Emblem Warriors, and you fuckers picked the iPhone game. God, that site pisses me off sometimes. I'm sorry. Anyway, what's your number 5, Sean?
All right, my number 5. So yeah, this is where we start moving into the top half of the list. This is where it starts getting really competitive. And now we get what is my last Western-made game and my last multi-platform game, which is the last of two, which is Wolfenstein 2: The New Colossus, which is my number 5 game of the year. This gets my Fuck Nazis Award, which is an award usually In any other year, you would never even think to have to give out. But, like, fucking, it's an award you have to give, and there's no game, like, now or ever made, and probably ever will be made, that is more deserving of the award, fuck Nazis, than Wolfenstein 2 The New Colossus. Wolfenstein 2 is just an utterly amazing and like, totally singular game. Which is a pretty impressive thing to be able to say about, one, something that is a sequel, because I think it's so, like, even, like, outstretches and outgoes the lengths of what Wolfenstein 1, The New Order, could really accomplish, and that game is a good stepping stone, but Wolfenstein 2 goes so much farther and so much higher than that game could ever accomplish. But then also, this is the successor to what is, like, literally one of the oldest franchises ongoing in video games ever. Like, this is the successor to fucking Wolfenstein. This is a video game that stars B.J. Blazkowicz, you know? Like, this, it is a fucking Wolfenstein game through and through. And New Order from 2014 was a really delightful surprise and did a lot of really interesting things. I don't have my 2014 Game of the Year list, but I remember it was on it somewhere. It was somewhere near the top. But, like, it was definitely not my number one. It was an interesting game, but very flawed in some ways. And Wolfenstein 2, while, like, the combat's not perfect and is certainly not better than Neo and did not deserve Best Action Game Award at the Game Awards, still, even though I ranked it higher than Neo, that's for other reasons. The action is not, like, the most remarkable thing about the game. Like, there are definitely better playing first-person shooters. You know, like, Doom from last year is a much more accomplished first-person shooter in terms of the combat. But what Wolfenstein 2 manages to do in blending that action and blending in the story, in particular the character work that they do, with the broader themes and how relevant and powerful those themes are to, like, right now, of dealing with fascism in America and, like, the American and, like, America's historical relationship to fascism, like, you know, dating back to the Ku Klux Klan and our history with white supremacy and our relationship towards the Nazis and stuff like that, and bringing that in and doing it with, like, you know, thoughtfulness and delicacy, but then also, like knowing where to be delicate and knowing, like, how to tread lightly in order to sort of, like, deliver those themes, and then also knowing where you just fucking push it to 11 and get fucking insane. I've never played a game like this. I've never played a game that mixed those things that well. Like, we talk a lot about, like, Naughty Dog being able to blend gameplay and cinematic stuff, and I think Naughty Dog is still in many ways the best in the business at that. But what Machine Games does in a similar vein, but, like, kind of like you fucking, like, took a bunch of fucking meth and did try to do the Naughty Dog thing, that's what Wolfenstein 2 feels like. That you just went fucking crazy with it. I mean, this is a game that does some shit that I don't want to really get into because you haven't played it. I don't want to spoil it for people. But, like, it doesn't fucking pull any punches. It does some of the most absurd things I've ever seen a story in any medium do. But it pulls off every single absurdity, and it gets more and more absurd as it goes on. But every single time it lands it all the way through the ending. I know there are a lot of people that have issues with the ending and feel like the game doesn't pace the ending out well. I completely disagree. I think this game has the fucking pitch-perfect ending. It is an amazing ending in how it contrasts to Wolfenstein 1. I think it like, culminates at, like, the perfect spot. It just... fucking everything about this game is so much fun. Because even though the shooting is not, I would say, as accomplished as Doom, the relationship that it has to the narrative and the momentum and pace of the narrative gives it so much energy and makes you so enthusiastic that, you know, you just get to run around and with, like, two shotguns and just fucking blow Nazis to little tiny chunky bits, and that's a great fucking time. You know, that's never not fun. And the like, you know, I talked about with Neo and power fantasies, like, Wolfenstein 2 delivers a very different kind of power fantasy. I guess, like, one thing that, like, this is a mild spoiler, but I'm not going to go, it's not a big deal, I don't think, is that one of the main sort of themes across the game, particularly in the first half of the game, is B.J. Blazkowicz's relationship with his abusive father. That's sort of how the game opens, with this flashback to his childhood and how his father is this racist, like, piece of shit who is, like, abusive and you know, I mean, he basically forces B.J. to shoot his own dog to sort of, like, assert control over B.J., which parallels with things that had happened in Wolfenstein 1. And also B.J.'s mom is Jewish, which is known from the fiction and deals with that directly. And then, like, you know, it's not, I think, a spoiler to say that you encounter that father character again about halfway through the narrative. And the way that this game deals with that confrontation, where BJ Blazkowicz goes from being this kid from the beginning of the game, that he's, you know, he's this young, like 10-year-old boy, like utterly under the thrall of this abusive patriarch of the family, and then now you re-encounter him again, but you are, now you're not just some kid, you're not little Billy, you're BJ fucking Blazkowicz, you're Terror Billy. You're the guy who makes this Nazi shit themselves when they think about you. Like, that's who you are. And there is this moment in that confrontation where that, where you encounter that dad again, and he is trying to sort of play his old power games and assert himself over BJ once again in that way, and BJ Blazkowicz just doesn't fucking have it anymore. And it is a moment that, and like then where it goes from there in the story is a moment that, like, which feels like it would be cliche in any other story, and like in any other story, like they would go, they would, like most other stories would turn left at this junction point. And would like and cower and turn left, and fucking Wolfenstein 2 says, no, fuck this, I'm going right. I'm going hard right, motherfucker. Like, this is that's not how this story is going. And the power fantasy that is implicit in that, and how BJ sort of not only confronts his abusive past, but rises above it and transcends it and fucking flips it the middle finger, is so distinct, and I've never seen a story in any medium deliver that moment to me and sort of like play that cliche to its advantage in that way. So this game also gets, I'm very, very delighted to be able to give this game the Best Dramatic Character Arc Award to BJ Blazkowicz.
That's so ridiculous.
Congratulations, because that is, the story is built around that progression of BJ being defeated and afraid at the beginning of this game because he's dying, because from the events of the end of the first game, and having to start from that place into this place of like defeat, and then like transcend that to the point where, you know, that he can kind of become whole and human again. And that's sort of his character arc.
One might even say that mirrors the arc for some parts of America in 2017.
Exactly. And it is like this, where the first game ends on this really sort of like dark moment of like sort of bittersweet moment of like you are passing like this literal torch off to a resistance that's going to carry on in the future. And that's where the sort of first game ends. The second game ends with this moment of like, it's like a weirdly happy ending of like, no, like we can transcend this if we work together, and we can be like, not only can we fight, but we can be happy in fighting. And that like message is so powerful and poignant and relevant. The other award I'm giving it is the Best Editing Award, because the last thing about this game is that, you know, I can talk all I want about how good the cutscenes are, but the thing that in particular is that the editing in the cutscenes is fucking amazing. And like it is a weird thing, and there are so many people that like profess this belief that video games should never have cutscenes, that all video game stories should be told entirely from like the perspective of the game, you should be in control of the game all the time. And I understand some of where that argument comes from, but I think Wolfenstein 2 is the best evidence that like that's not always what you need. That cutscenes,
that's a stupid argument.
Yeah, it's a stupid argument, and like cutscenes done well can do something that you could never deliver in like when the player has control of the camera. And one of those things is editing. And the fucking editing in this game is so fucking good. There's some cutscenes in this game that are just incredible, particularly the one that they showed bits of it in the E3 trailer, but like you can like find this on YouTube because it's sort of like siloed off enough from the rest of the game that even if you haven't played the game, I recommend just like find the cutscene of BJ going to New Orleans and encountering this old socialist from New Orleans, and they he's basically like a like card carrying communist, and they sit down and talk about like whose fault is it, like you or us, for why the Nazis have gotten control of America, because the communist guy is saying like we were fighting this like before you were born, like you fuckers, like you always called us lefties and commies and put us down, and like we were telling you about the dangers of this shit forever ago. And then and BJ's saying, yeah, but when when shit got real and World War II started, like you guys didn't fight. And I went there, like I was fighting Nazis while you guys were here and arguing about politics. And where that debate goes and that discussion goes is so interesting and so hilarious and dramatic and weird and fucking just utterly unique. And it hinges so much on the writing of the performances, but particularly the editing of that cutscene to deliver that moment. And then that transitions into one of my favorite gameplay parts of the game because of all the energy from that cutscene. So I think Wolfenstein 2 is just a remarkable fucking game. It is a game for our age, it is a game for our time, but it is also still only the fifth best game of the year to me.
One more note on that cutscene thing, because I think it's a fascinating thing to talk about. You know, I'm someone, just look at the kinds of games I pick. Cutscene-driven games tend to be less interesting to me. But to me, like, I still think that's a ridiculous argument, because cutscenes are just a tool in a toolbox.
Yeah.
And, you know, it depends on how good you are at using the tools. If you're good at using the tools, then it's a really necessary tool to use.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. Like, it's... I love that you noted the editing there, because video games, that's just not a term we use much, but sometimes it is a necessary term. I think we're still at a point where it's not often integrated into gameplay, which I'd like to see more of, like Virginia last year. But I think it's a really good thing to highlight, because games come in all shapes and sizes, and sometimes you need those just cinematic infusions.
Yeah, and that's the right way to look at it. Like, cutscenes are a tool, and I have never seen a game use that tool better than Wolfenstein 2.
Awesome. My number 5 game of the year is Metroid Samus Returns.
All right.
Sean, for the Nintendo 3DS. Sean, can I just try to tell you how happy I am that on this podcast that we have been doing since 2012,
right,
there hasn't even been a Metroid game in the time this podcast has been on. But not only was there a Metroid game, but it's so good I got to rank it at number 5 on my top 10 list. This is like a religious experience for me, Sean. This is so cool. Going into 2017, I think you and I even talked about this on the show, we just thought Metroid was a dead series.
Yeah.
Because... here's the thing, there actually has been one Metroid game since we started, and that's Metroid Prime Federation Force, which, to this day, no one has played. Fun fact, no one's ever played it.
Yeah, like, I watched a video of it, of what I thought was being played, and I later discovered it was just a computer algorithm playing the game.
Yeah, no one's ever played the game. And so we just, I think, all kind of thought, like, Metroid was something like Star Fox or F-Zero, one of these different kind of franchises that Nintendo had just kind of thrown off the cart somewhere along the journey. But no, at E3 this year, we got the glorious announcement that Metroid Prime 4 is in development for the Switch, which is cool enough. But I think it was even cooler to get the announcement for Metroid Samus Returns, because that game was done, it was locked, they'd made it in secret, and it was coming out in like 2 months. And we got it, and Metroid Samus Returns is the real deal. It is straight from the tap, undiluted Metroid. And if you have any love for this series or this kind of game, you need to play this game because it is so good. It definitely is kind of a sister game to Fire Emblem Echoes in that it's the other great 3DS game from this year that is almost but not quite a remake. In this case, Samus Returns... takes its cues from Metroid 2 Return of Samus for the original Game Boy, also kind of a black sheep sequel in the Metroid series, because, you know, it doesn't quite have the same level of innovation that means that the original Metroid had that allows that game to kind of stick around as relevant all these years later. But it has all kind of the bad parts of that game. It has no map system, very rudimentary combat, all those things. So it's been really hard for anyone getting into Metroid now to go back to Metroid 2. So what they did is they, kind of like they did with Metroid Zero Mission on the Game Boy Advance, is they took kind of the basic structural outline of Metroid 2, gave it to a new developer and said, run, fly, do your thing. In this case, I should note, the developer was Mercury Steam, which is a Spanish company. Had not really heard of them before, but I think they hit this one out of the park. They did have a lot of guidance from Nintendo. Like, if you look at the credits, it's all Spanish names, and then, like, at least each department has several Japanese names in it, too. So clearly, a lot of Nintendo's people went over there and worked on them with it. And it's just a glorious rebirth for Metroid. It has the tightest and most fluid controls that series has ever had. The way it does combat in 2D. Like, this game might have the best combat of any Metroid game, 2D or 3D. It's just so fluid, so fast. It has this great melee counter thing. Because they give you so many more little combat tools, you know, you can aim in 360 degrees, all those kinds of things. It allows them to make the game much, much harder than other 2D Metroid games. And it's a really rewarding challenge throughout. It's got this immersive, open-ended level design. I love that what they chose to do here is it's that kind of traditional 2D Metroid open area design, but it's not one giant open area like Super Metroid was. It's a series of them. And so you kind of get that Metroid hit consistently, but there's also like an end point to it every once in a while where you've kind of done everything in that area and then it's time to move on and you have a whole new map to go through. Which also means the game is actually substantially longer than any other 2D Metroid game. It's like a 20-hour campaign. Super Metroid is like 5 or 6, you know, right, if you're comparing these. So it's got, you know, all the stellar upgrades that you get, you know, and they've added some cool new upgrades here. I love the Aeon abilities that they give you. Those are so fun. It's got the perfect music, the perfect sound design, so atmospheric, and it's easily got the most incredible graphics the Nintendo 3DS has ever had. I've talked about this before, but the 3D in this game, you've got to play it with the 3D on, because the backgrounds look so deep that it looks like you could just stroll several miles into the distance. Some of the best use of 3D I've ever seen in anything, movies or games or whatever. And with all of that combined, Samus Returns is just such a playable game. I don't even know what other word to use for it. It is just so fun to pick up and play that game, and every ounce of its game design is so ludicrously rewarding in every single way. And all of it hits that sweet spot that is so unique to Metroid. And it did it so perfectly for me that when I finished this game, and this is the biggest testament I can give it, when I finished Metroid Samus Returns, it returned me to the main menu, and I started a new file, and I started it on the hardest difficulty, and I played Samus Returns to 100% completion, as in every item, every upgrade, every missile, all of that. I played it to 100% completion twice in a row. I have never done that for another game.
So for you, you get that game for you gets what I call the game so nice, I played it twice award.
I like that. Yes. I like that. See, I don't have whatever gene you have that allows you to make snappy award titles.
Yeah.
But yes, game's so nice, I played it twice. You know, like, I guess I played Sonic Mania twice, but it's a very different kind of thing, because I don't know.
That's a different kind of game. Yeah. Like, of course you play it twice.
Yeah. And Sonic Mania also, like, you don't 100% that game in the same way. No, Samus Returns, like, I explored every inch of that game twice in a row. Didn't play anything in between, just played it twice. It is an amazing game, and I would say, whether you own a 3DS or not, Samus Returns is in kind of a tie with me right now with The Legend of Zelda Link Between Worlds for the best game on the Nintendo 3DS. And just those two games alone, either one of them is reason to buy that system, that they keep making games. The 3DS is an old system at this point. It launched in 2011. It's been out for 6 years, and two of its best games came out this year. That's incredible to me, and I think Samus Returns, as I said, is, it's either 1 or 2, 1 or 1A, something like that, for the best game on this platform. That is an amazing thing, and if you own a 3DS, play Samus Returns. If you don't own a 3DS, you should get a 3DS, and you should play Samus Returns, and a lot of other games, but Samus Returns, it's the real deal. Holy shit, I am so happy I got to talk about a Metroid game and a new Metroid game on one of our year-end podcasts.
Yes, it's been a long time coming. It's an underrepresented franchise in these days.
And we'll get to do it again unless Metroid Prime 4 sucks, but it probably won't.
Or if it ever comes out, who knows?
Who knows? Rumors that the next Direct will have that prominently, so
that'd be nice.
I'm excited. But that's my number 5. Deep breath. Sean, let's keep going. Number 4.
My number 4 game is a game you talked about a little bit already. I'm going to talk a lot more about. My number 4 game is Gravity Rush 2.
Nice.
Gravity Rush 2 is the best way that I think to open this conversation is to give it the most delightful award, which is, I think, I took a long time trying to come up with what is the adjective I need to use to describe Gravity Rush 2, because it needs to be one word, and delightful is the word I came up with, because it is a pure fucking delight. Like, it is just everything about that game, the characters, the character designs, like, just the whole graphical style and the art style of the world, the movement is just majestic and beautiful, and it's addictive to fly around that world, not even fly around, but to fall all over that world and to pick up these gems that are all over the place, and then eventually they kind of, like, regenerate the gems for you once you hit a specific point of the story, and there's a bunch of new gems to get, and then you keep on going and getting gems, and you know, the characters are purely delightful, and Kat, as you said in your part, is just one of the best video game protagonists I think there is. She doesn't have quite the dramatic character arc and, like, the nicely consigned dramatic character arc of BJ Blazkowicz, so she doesn't quite win that award, but she's easily the most delightful video game protagonist of any game I've ever played. And the soundtrack is just gorgeous. The soundtrack is so, so beautiful in this game. In fact, the composer Kohei Tanaka, who people might know as a composer from Mobile Fighter G Gundam, if you watched Mobile Fighter G Gundam, which if you did, you know the music in that show was fucking amazing. And Gravity Rush 2 is one of the best. I did not, and I have not, and cannot tell you what the best soundtrack in video games was this year, because there are three. Like, two of them we haven't talked about yet. But Gravity Rush 2's soundtrack, I listened to all the time because I think it's just amazing, and it's even better in the game, but it has the most creative instrumentation I think I've heard in a video game soundtrack. If you like xylophones, this has xylophones. If you like pan flutes, it's got pan flutes. If you like harmonica, it's got harmonica. If you like banjos, got banjos.
I want that on the Game of the Year edition for Gravity Rush 2. If you like pan flutes, this is the game for you. Sean Chapman, Weekly Stuff Podcast.
I mean, it has a song that has, like, steel drums of, like, fucking bass guitar, an electric guitar, a pan flute solo, and a xylophone solo. That's a fucking track on the soundtrack of this video game. Has all of those instruments together. It's just amazing. But then, like, really what it is with Gravity Rush 2, for me, is it's the story. And it's like, and how the story obviously, like, fits together with all those things. And it's not just, like, the big narrative, but it's all the small narratives. This has been a big year for games that depict mundanity to me. There's one other game a little bit higher on this list that does it even better, I think, than Gravity Rush 2. But video games so rarely ever even attempt to approach depicting mundanity, unless it's something that's, you know, like a game that is mundane in and of itself, like a Sims or something like that. But a like superhero game, which is what Gravity Rush is and Gravity Rush 2 is one of the best superhero soundtracks, is the Gravity Rush 2 soundtrack. Like, you so rarely ever get in a superhero game the mundane side of things, you know? Like, when you play the Arkham games, as much as I love those games, you never get the mundanity of Batman's life. You never really get that, like, oh, he has to be Bruce Wayne some of the time. You know, he has to deal with normal people. It's all about, he's trapped in this big area that has all the villains are in it, and there's no normal civilians to deal with, and it's you know, he's Batman all the time. It's that kind of thing. It's one of the things we talked about with the most recent Spider-Man trailer, is it was refreshing to see Peter Parker in a trailer for a Spider-Man game, because every Spider-Man game is your Spider-Man 100% of the time. And for Gravity Rush 2, you know, Kat doesn't have a secret identity. She is who she is. She just happens to have these powers. And it just so happens that the people of the world she lives in are in no way object to asking her to use her amazing, like, mysterious powers to do just utterly mundane stuff. And one of, like, my favorite memories of this game is a side quest where you help a lady move, and you just pick up furniture and put it in the back of her truck, and that's, like, the whole side mission is that.
That's a great mission.
It's great, and there's all these amazing side quests where you just do random normal chores. Some of them are, like, really goofy. This game is incredibly funny when it wants to be funny. But it also has this heart at its core, and that's one of the reasons why it gets to be the most delightful game, is that it has this brilliant, beautiful, shining heart at its core. But that shining heart isn't just in you know, like, the beautiful aesthetics and the beautiful music and the fun, goofy sense of humor and all that stuff. It also is, it has this heart in how it reflects on, like, real powerful social issues. So I'm incredibly overjoyed to be able to give Gravity Rush 2 the Best Marxist Game Award. Because that's what it is. It is literally the best game I've ever played at dealing with Marxist themes. And I have a fucking bachelor's degree in English literature. I know a thing or two about Marxist themes. If you are not someone who has any experience with Marxism, go to a fucking, like, 3,000 level English course at any random university, and that professor is, like, sucking Marx's dick. And some of it I'm not all into. I think there are issues with Marxism, as there is with any sort of, like, political ideology. But it is something that, like, so much literature and fiction has those elements because, you know, class issues and socioeconomic disparity is a core feature of every human society that I've ever known. And it is an important thing to try to tackle in stories, and every story I think probably deals with it on one level or another, but I've never seen a game deal with it so directly, but again with such insight and such heart and such empathy as what Gravity Rush 2 does. And, you know, I talked about that, like, furniture moving quest, but that quest is not just about moving furniture, but it's also with you engaging with this idea that, like, well, these are people that can move, you know, like, this is, like, these are people that live in the upper echelons of society that can afford to just ask you, like, hey, just move my furniture. Like, you, like, random woman, you're probably, like, you know, some beggar on the streets, you just move my furniture for me. And the other most memorable part of the game for me is, well, the other most memorable part of the game is sort of, like, the ending and the credits and that song and that stuff. But also that moment near the beginning of the game when you are first tasked with going to the Undercity. And you've engaged entirely with this middle level area, and then you kind of go to the top level for a little bit. And then you're asked, to go down and go to the Undercity and to basically, like, these people are telling you, like, and you assume they're criminals living down there. They've stolen this stuff, and I'm going to go, and I'm this good superhero. I'm going to go beat them up and get this person's property back. And you go down there, and you fall, because you see that the waypoint is pointing just straight down to that, so you just fall. And you fall, and you fall, and you fall until you're falling through these polluted, dusty, smoky, disgusting clouds and end up in this shanty town that is like thousands of feet below where everybody else lives, where the middle class lives and the upper class lives. And you find out that, I mean, they did steal some stuff, but they stole some stuff because they needed to be able to live, because they are not given any of the resources or opportunities that anybody else is given. And that is what spurs... that's what spurs Kat to become like a classic Superman-esque superhero, that she's not just a superhero that fights for the status quo, which is what so many superheroes are. She's a superhero that fights to change the status quo in a like Robin Hood or something, to try to defeat this class disparity and the socioeconomic disparity. And that's not just something that part of the game deals with. If, like, you know, I talked a lot about the story in our, like, big Gravity Rush to spoiler cast from near the beginning of the year. So you can go to that if you want to hear all the details of this. But then where the movie, or there, then when the game moves into that sort of, like, the Gravity Rush 3 part of it and that kind of stuff, where it expands the story and kind of brings you back home from Gravity Rush 1 and that kind of stuff, it recontextualizes what Gravity Rush 1 was in this new Marxist context and lets you know that, like, that's always what this franchise has been about. You didn't quite see it because it wasn't as direct, but those elements were there in the first game, and there's a couple of elements about it that were there in the setting of the first game that you just didn't engage with yet, and now it is time for us to engage with that. And I think that reveal for me of, like, the full scope of what this franchise is and what this grander narrative that Gravity Rush 1 and Gravity Rush 2 are really telling was incredibly powerful to me. I think it's a kind of game that if I, like was to teaching these, like, concepts and like, this is a game I would ask people to play and, like, let's talk about it in, like, an academic context, because I think there's so much rich narrative there to pull out. And it's all delivered, you know, with wit and charm and heart and empathy and with, you know, that brilliant soundtrack and that brilliant art style and those brilliant characters and just that, you know, sense of movement and grace that infuses everything about the actual playing of the game. That you know, this was a game that when I started the list, I thought it was going to be, like, lower than it was, but then every time I was thinking about it more and more and more, and then I played a little bit of it again, it just kept on pushing up this list until now it is, in my opinion, the fourth best game of this year.
I'm going to amend my previous comment. For the Game of the Year edition of Gravity Rush 2, I want in big red letters on the bottom of the box, yeah, best Marxist game.
Yes.
Yes.
And it has to be red letters, yeah, specifically.
No, I said it for a reason, yeah. Best Marxist game, Sean Chapman, the Weekly Stuff podcast.
Yes.
Yes.
It's the official award.
Yes. That would be, I could die happy if somehow we got that comment onto a re-release of Gravity Rush 2.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing.
I think I am maybe, like, the biggest champion for this game I've seen, so...
So, Sean, you gave that game your Most Delightful award.
Yeah.
From Most Delightful to Least Delightful...
Okay.
We go to my number 4, which is not a delightful game. That's its award. This is not a delightful game. It's Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice.
Oh, I'm glad that these two are paired together.
It's very weird. It is very weird. Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice is a game by Ninja Theory, a studio that has done a lot of interesting projects in the past, but decided to take on a real passion project here. And basically had a small team of 20, and if you hear that and then look at the game, you'd be like, how the fuck did a team of 20 make this thing? Basically made a AAA game as an indie game almost. Like this little, like, under-the-radar thing that is so much about experimentation and narrative. And it wound up being a huge hit this year. It had a lot of presence at the Game Awards this month. It recently broke even for the company, so it was a success for them. But Hellblade is a really hard game to talk about. And I've been thinking a lot about how to talk about it. One thought I had earlier while we were recording this podcast is that talking about Hellblade feels like talking about a dream I had, because it is so intense and experiential and sensory. And I think this game is easily the biggest innovation I played this year in terms of telling a story through gameplay, is Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice. Because I think more than any game I've ever played, Hellblade makes full and visceral use of the most experiential qualities of the video game medium. Because what this game sets out to do, and it is not setting out to have fun, it is setting out to instill in players a sense of psychosis and turmoil. And it succeeds in powerful and harrowing fashion by inviting and allowing the player to inhabit the tortured soul of another. And I knew the game was working on me in a way no other game ever has, when roughly 2 hours into the game, I realized I was having active trouble breathing. And not like, oh, I free, like just literally, like when you say, like, this movie is breathless. Like, no, it was actually a problem. It's the main physiological symptom of my own anxiety, and I'd forgotten to take my medication that day, and so the game was triggering it. And that all may sound like a weird recommendation. And to be sure, I only think you should play Hellblade if you know what you're getting yourself into. This isn't a game you play to have fun. Just as you don't go watch certain art house or avant-garde films for simple entertainment, you know? This is a game you play to experience something artistically profound and technically masterful, to see the video game medium pushed to its absolute limits in service of telling a story that I think simply could not be told, at least with this degree of immediacy and sophistication, in any other format. There's so many things you could talk about on a technical level here. Again, Ninja Theory, I think, had a huge accomplishment with this game. The art design and graphics are as good as any AAA game on the market. They're utterly breathtaking, and they modulate between natural beauty and visual horror with real fluidity in a way that is often startling and terrifying. Even more significant, I think, and you've probably heard about this before, is that the game has ridiculously immersive sound design, because they've done it all through binaural audio. And so this is a game that you must experience with headphones. But I think it's the most accomplished and essential use of sound I have ever heard in a video game. And sound beyond all the things we talk about normally when we talk about sound. Like, the voice acting is great, the music's great, but it's how all of those combine in this game, where the whole goal of the sound design is to make you feel like you are in Senua's head between her two ears, hearing what she hears, whether it's from the real world or not, because a lot of what's in this game is not something that's actually happening. So much of this game is internal and allegorical. The voice work throughout is outstanding, but the central performance by Melina Jurgens is just a knockout in voice and physicality, because she did the mocap for the game. And she puts so much humanity and personal history into this broken character at every turn. And a really cool story, Melina Jurgens was the video editor at Ninja Theory. She wasn't an actor, and she was just doing the stand-in work for Senua, as you often do on a video game, until they realized how perfectly she embodied the character. And that's a thing that, like, goes back to, like, the beginning days of animation, is this is a thing that happens where just, like, you have these happy accidents with performances. This is also a game that is one of many pop culture things this year that deals deeply with Nordic gods and legends and oral traditions. Like, the one connection between this and Thor Ragnarok, which are very different experiences, is that they both do end with a confrontation with Hela, god of death.
Okay.
Goddess of death. So, you know, if you liked Thor Ragnarok, you probably won't like Hellblade Senua's Sacrifice. But just know that that's a similarity. Anyway, I'm going to read a little bit from my notes here. Hellblade is ultimately an astonishingly universal story. Despite all that, you know, very great Nordic cultural texture, it's astonishingly universal about how one's emotional pain and feelings of difference or isolation can leave one stranded inside a purgatory of the self. It's a sprawling yet deft, intimate yet maximalist story about the flagellation a person can impart upon themselves in order to heal. And no matter how fantastic the imagery becomes, no matter how severe Senua's mental illness grows, it is shocking how much of this game feels recognizable and relatable. And getting back to what I was saying about gameplay, it does all of this through the gameplay. This is one of those games that totally finds a way to do everything it has to offer without cutscenes, without cinematic edits. It is a, you know, video game-ass video game. And what it does with this severe, intense combat that makes you feel like you're an inch away from dying every second, and these sort of sinister environmental puzzles that don't feel like they come out of, like, the literal, like, grass and trees so much as Senua's perception of the grass and trees, which is a small but powerful difference. All of that adds up to a story that could not be told passively. It demands interaction, and being an active part of it, of how it all unfolds, makes it so utterly unforgettable. I've never played anything like Hellblade. I'm really not sure if I will ever have the will to play this game again, but I know that that one evening I spent, like, binging this entire game was one of the most riveting and painful and moving and thought-provoking, and by the end, uplifting, because I think this game has hope in its heart, experiences I have ever had in this medium. I think it's one of the great achievements in the history of games, and not an easy achievement to, you know, break down and experience, but it is something you absolutely should if you can.
All right.
So that's Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice. It is not Gravity Rush 2.
No, it gets the most stressful game award.
Sure, yeah. It is a stressful-ass game.
All right. So now we move into the top three, Jonathan. And while I'm looking at this list, I've sort of realized something is that in any other year, like my top five, any of those games could easily be number one. Like Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus, if this was 2015, maybe wouldn't quite beat Witcher 3. But like if this was 2014, easily game of the year. Like Gravity Rush 2 also, like easily game of the year in like a weaker year. And that's also obviously true of my top three games. But the other thing that's true about my top three games is all three of these games are like would be among like the best games I've ever played. And that's how like you know that this is a really fucking good year for games.
Can I say that too? Because that's one thing about Hellblade is like a second number one for me because there's my top three and then everything else.
Yeah.
And so Hellblade was like the top of the rest. My top three, I wrote this in my intro. I agree, they're three of the best games I've ever played. In any other year, all of these top three would be absolute game of the years. Also, we're coming up on Game of the Decade stuff in 2019.
Oh, gosh.
My top three of this year might just be my top three for the decade. Like, there might be some things I'd insert or move around, but they would be very, very competitive on that list. Like, it's the top three this year are so insanely competitive to me.
Yeah, yeah. So it is definitely like, if I had the same thing of my top three have been my top three for since I finished the most recent game I finished of the top three, which was a while ago. So it has been this for a long time. Anyways, without further ado, my number three game of the year and one of just the most amazing fucking games I've ever played is Yakuza 0. Yakuza 0 is a game...
I knew it was coming!
It had to be coming. It came out in 2015 in Japan. It's like, fuck you guys, why did you hold on to this for so long? Because I didn't know how much I needed this fucking video game. It is one of the games of, like, this and Gravity Rush 2 and Horizon Zero Dawn that just made, like, one of the most amazing, like, beginnings to any year of video games I've ever played. Yakuza 0 came out in January of this year, which was good because it is a very long video game. This is, Nioh was the earliest game in this game I played over 100 years or hours in. It could have been 100 years. Yakuza 0 is another game that I played over 100 hours in, and I would gladly play it a bunch more. Like, if I had all the time in the world, I would play through this whole fucking video game again. And when I say the whole game, I mean the whole game. I played the shit out of Yakuza 0. Because Yakuza 0 is just, like, basically completely and utterly unique. I've never, ever, ever played a game like it. The only other game I've played like it is the honorable mention of Yakuza Kiwami, which is the remake of Yakuza 1 that you know, I kind of like, kind of you can kind of put Kiwami and Zero together in this list in a weird way, but, you know, Yakuza Zero is the better of the two, and it's the real fucking deal. And what makes Yakuza Zero remarkable to me is so many things of that. I think it has one of those strangest blends of gameplay and narrative I've seen, but one that works so well. Like with Gravity Rush 2, Yakuza Zero is a game that, while it can deal in melodrama in so many ways, and it deals in melodrama fantastically, is also a game that is very concerned with mundanity, and not just mundanity, but the absurdity of mundanity. Yakuza Zero is one of, if not maybe the funniest video game I've ever played. There is shit in this game that I still cannot believe that they've done. There are side quests that are hilarious. There's a side quest that I've been thinking about this because I actually like ran into someone recently that I didn't realize I'd also played Yakuza 0 but had, and we started talking about it. Started talking about one of the side quests in this game is a side quest where this like probably like 10-year-old boy or something like that who's confused about this one vending machine that's in this back alleyway that sells, let's say, slightly objectionable material because this game is all set in the 80s in Japan, and he's confused by it, and his friends have told him, like, get these magazines that are in this vending machine, and so he goes up and asks Kiryu, the main character, like, hey, can you, like I've heard these magazines, I want ones, like, and Kiryu goes on this whole journey of, like, the moral implications of this. And then eventually decides, like, well, you need to eventually, like, sort of blossom into manhood, and it's okay to be curious about these things. But he's very embarrassed at the idea of having to walk up to this vending machine and buy a pornographic magazine from this vending machine. And so it turns into a fucking stealth mission where he has to sneak past people to be able to, like, surreptitiously approach this vending machine and buy this magazine. And then he gives it to this kid. And the kid says, like, yay! And he walks off. And before he leaves, Kiryu tells him, and don't hide it under your bed. because it's not as good a hiding place as you think it is. And the kid runs off, and then Kiryu stares up into the night sky, as so many of the side quests in this game ends with Kiryu staring up into the night sky and thinking to himself, did I do the right thing here? And like the game is full of these just like insane, crazy, weird fucking side quests like that that are so funny. On the one of the podcasts when I was playing through this game, I talked about the side quest where you have to go deliver a pizza to a person who's a foreigner because they keep on asking him to help them with their visa, but he can't understand them because they're not speaking proper Japanese, and so he keeps on thinking they're saying pizza, and so you have to go get a pizza for them. And then there was a whole cross deal brand with an actual, I forget which brand it was, but a real Japanese pizza chain, and you go and you get this actual pizza and then like run it to them like holding it aloft and playing like basically like the you know free version of like the Chariots of Fire theme song as you like gallantly stride up to them with this pizza, and they say like, no, I'm asking for a visa. And it's like the most absurd comedy, but it's so funny, and the game is full of that stuff. It also is chock full of these amazing, amazing mini games, and every single mini game in this game feels like something that could be its own whole own video game. The dancing mini game in this game is just incredible. There's no other game dancing like rhythm game that's like it. I want them to just make a game that has those mechanics and a bunch of their weird songs.
Yakuza 0 Dancing All Night.
Yes, Yakuza 0 Dancing All Night. Yes, because that would be fucking amazing. And the game has such an earnestness to it. Maybe that is the best word for this game. It is so earnest, because everything about Kiryu and then Majima, the other protagonist, is when they are in side quest land, like they approach everything with this like earnest heart of just like, we're gonna go for it. Like, I don't care if you're like, if I'm dancing, I don't care if I'm going to karaoke, I don't care if I'm like buying this pornographic magazine for this kid, I don't care if I'm playing like, you know, like basically Pocket Racer, where like you build a little like race car and like race it around tracks like a NASCAR car, like whatever it is, Kiryu goes at it with 120% with everything he has, and he is overjoyed every time, like the animations he has when he wins a dancing competition, or when you go up and do like the pocket circuit racing mini quest chain, which is one of the best in the game because of just the absurd places it goes to. And when you start one of those missions, you know, he has this cutscene where he picks up his custom-made pocket racer car and shoves it into the camera, like, triumphantly and daringly, of like, we're gonna do this and I'm gonna win, and like dramatically shouting out the name of the car, like, Iron Golem! And then it cuts to these plastic cars, tiny little plastic cars, racing around a tiny little plastic circuit, and he's just like, come on, go, go, go! And stuff like that in Japanese. And all that's brilliant. All the music in the game is also fantastic. Like, they have the proper soundtrack is great. But then also all the fake music in the game of their, like, fake 80s Japanese music. There's the dancing music is great because it has this variety of, like, a fake Michael Jackson song by Miracle Johnson, where there's a whole side quest chain where you help Miracle Johnson shoot basically the equivalent of the Thriller music video, where you have to protect him from the zombie, like, extras to make this music video. There's one of the songs, probably my favorite one, is, like, Koi Disco Love or something like that, which is, like, this... It could be, like, it's the perfect fucking song that would just be the opening animation, like, theme song to any 80s anime, like, any 80s Gundam show or something like that. It's just fucking perfect. Like, all of that is perfect. The recreation, obviously, I've never been to 1980s Japan, but their vision of 1980s Japan is so compelling and so interesting and ties in with these historical themes that are really powerful in that, like, depiction of the economic boom, basically the Japanese equivalent of, like, the Roaring Twenties, so, like, kind of Great Gatsby-style stuff. Like that sort of moneyed culture in the sense of, like, nothing matters because we're so prosperous, and it's not, the story is not about gangs getting money, it's about gangs getting real estate, because that's, like, what we need, because it's so packed, and that's where all the money is, because we're drowning in yen. We don't need any yen. We just want more real estate, because that's how you make more yen. That's how, you know, you become a successful gang. So all of that stuff, all the side stuff, everything around the periphery is just amazing. It's hilarious. It's enthusiastic in all the right ways, and it's addictive in all the right ways. But then also, it is the core of the game, which tells this dramatic story that has such a, like, fascinating finger on these characters and, like, on the pulse of these characters and who they are. Of Kiryu, who's the sort of, like, the main star of the franchise, and then Majima, who is this sort of, like, anti-hero, like, sometimes antagonist, sometimes companion sort of character. And it being a prequel, even though I hadn't played the rest of the franchise, its sense of like the story being about these two men whose stories never directly intersect. Like they never meet each other properly. Like near the end of the game, there's a scene where they meet, but that's like kind of outside the confines of the normal story. It is very much that it's a parallel plot line where things about the plots that they are engaging with intersect, but they do not as characters ever intersect. And instead it's about seeing how they are built up and how it's really like this weird sort of almost like Bildungsroman kind of story about how these two young men like grow up into adults, like improper adults, and become the characters that they will be in future games, and how you are shaped by the people you meet at this stage in your life and these role models you encounter with. That if Majima had met the people that Kiryu had met, he may have been more like Kiryu and been more like grounded, insane, and rational. And if Kiryu had had the experiences that Majima had, he would have probably been more on that side. And seeing how that, like, their environment and the people around you shape you, it is like a really highly accomplished, incredibly well-written, incredibly well-presented dramatic story. This is one that, like, I gave Wolfenstein 2 the New Colossus, like, best editing and best, like, cutscene stuff. I think that is basically true because I don't even know if I call the cutscenes in Yakuza 0 cutscenes. They're just basically movies. And like in like, you know, like Hideo Kojima, Metal Gear Solid 4 style in a way. But instead of it just being obnoxious, it works so beautifully. Majima's character introduction in this game, that's I think the beginning of chapter 4, is like the best Yakuza movie. It's just, it's like 30 minutes long. Legitimately, it's like 20 to 30 minutes long. It starts off completely removed from everything about Kazuma Kiryu. You know, he's not even a part of it. It's in Osaka instead of Tokyo. And, like, the slow build-up and reveal of who is your secondary playable character, who is really, like, in some ways the biggest star of the game because the story's, I think, most interested in what Majima does and, like, uses him to contrast Kiryu. But yeah, that whole cutscene, like, even if you're not going to spend the time to play the whole game, just look up Majima's introduction cutscene on YouTube because it is absolutely incredible. Like, there's so much stuff to talk about with this game. I'm going to go into giving it some of my awards. The first award I'm going to give it is a repeat award. I never thought I would be able to give this award to another game because it is a very specific award. But last year on the podcast, I gave Final Fantasy XV Miyuki Sawashiro's award for peculiar excellence, which is a very specific award that I have personally and officially and properly, and like this is all 100% absolutely true, been empowered by the estate and the personage of Miyuki Sawashiro, the brilliant, amazing Japanese voice actress, to give this award in her name, which can only go to a game that meets three different qualities. It has to, one, feature the brilliant, beautiful, amazing, incredibly talented voice actress Miyuki Sawashiro in a prominent role. The game must be peculiar, and it must be excellent in its peculiarity. And again, those are three conditions that no game before Final Fantasy XV had ever quite met. And I thought no game since Final Fantasy XV would ever meet. Little did I know that nigh 2 months after playing Final Fantasy XV would I encounter another game that, one, stars Miyuki Sawashiro in a prominent role as Makimura Makoto, who is like one of the most important characters in the game. A game that is incredibly, absurdly excellent, is one of the best games I've ever played, and is also the most peculiar game I've ever played. So there has never been, and I'm now really laying my chips down, that there will never be a game that more suitably deserves the award. I am honored to be able to give Yakuza 0 Miyuki Sawashiro's award for peculiar excellence.
Did you know, Sean, that Miyuki Sawashiro voices Valkyrie in Thor Ragnarok in Japan?
No, but that's amazing.
That's pretty cool. She's also Unikitty in the Lego Movie, which I just love. That's she's so perfect for that. I just look at her list of credits. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah,
there's so many good ones.
She's really fucking good. I just love her voice. I love her performance. And then the fun thing about Yakuza 0 is that the character she plays, Makimura Makoto, is just like a normal person, like you know, relatively speaking, like it's
as normal as you can be in a Yakuza story.
Because it's not anime. Like that's not what Yakuza 0 is going for. Like the absurdity and that kind of stuff. It's not that sort of like otaku manga anime sort of thing. It is like it's an extreme Yakuza story. And if you are a fan of Yakuza movies, like you are, Jonathan, you need to play Yakuza 0.
I do regret that I didn't get to Yakuza 0. I also feel like this is a pretty evergreen game. If I play it 3 years from now, 4, it'll still be great.
Another award I get to give it is also an award I gave last year. I give it the I Like Shenmue Award which last year Shenmue won the I Like Shenmue award because last year I played Shenmue. I still haven't quite gone around to Shenmue 2 because it's been a big fucking year for video games. But Yakuza 0 and like the Yakuza franchise, while it's not, I think some people overstate the comparison to Shenmue, there's definitely a lot of Shenmue DNA in there, and like specifically the way it like approaches mundanity and like sort of brings that into the scope of the game instead of just dealing with these sort of like heightened events and like heightened action and dealing with like real world things. That is very much the Shenmue thing. So Yakuza 0 also gets the I Like Shenmue award. But the last thing I want to say about the game, like, you know, it's got the brilliant story, it's got the hilarious side quests, it's got the incredible setting, the incredibly realized characters. But the other thing about the game is that it is a game, and it is so fucking fun to play. The combat in this game, while it's not, it's certainly not nearly as accomplished a combat system as Neo, I would never say that, it is just absurdly fun. It is, because it is just... It, like everything else in the game, it goes 120% with it, and you're just picking up dudes, and you're slamming them into street rails, and you're fucking hitting them over the head with baseball bats, and you're just, like, you know, slamming them into the pavement, and fucking some of, like, the moves you get later in the game of where, you know, you just pick up a guy and spin him in a circle and knock over, like, four people around you with him, that kind of stuff. Or the best one, which is the beast mode, like, or beast style technique, which is, like, the standing still heat action, where you just... literally pick someone up, spin them around, jump up into the air, and just drop them on their head into the pavement is so fucking good. So the sort of the power fantasy, like, brawler gameplay that this game does is always a thrill to engage with. And I think, like, that it is never better expressed in the game than the boss fights. It has just some of the fucking best boss fights in any game I've ever played because it is the culmination of the brilliant, like, sort of melodramatic character-based storytelling that the Yakuza 0 and the Yakuza games generally do so well, and they build up characters like Kuze, who is a, like, Yakuza chief that Kiryu encounters multiple times over the course of the story. It builds up that dramatic relationship with them so beautifully. There is just this incredible cutscene that introduces your, like, the second boss fight with Kuze, where you're running, you're trying to flee the Yakuza, and you flee, like, through this sewer pipe, and you think you've gotten away, but actually Kuze has tricked you into taking that route, and he's waiting for you on the other end of the sewer pipe with a lead pipe in hand on a fucking motorcycle, and he starts driving down the sewer pipe with the lead pipe, like, scraping off the side of the sewer pipe, screaming at you and fucking smacks you with it, and that's how, like, that boss fight starts, with, like, the electric guitar, like, ramping up as he's driving down, just shouting, "Kiryu!" And then it, like, crescendos with him, like, hitting you, and, like you have this dramatic conversation, and then his name, Daisaku Kuze, just slams on the screen in giant text as the rock guitar just crescendos, and then you have this badass fucking just fist fight with the two of them. But it, the best one is, and I don't think this is in any way a spoiler, because this game is not about that kind of stuff with the plot, is the last boss fight is just the most incredible fucking thing ever. And it starts with, you know, there's built up this confrontation in the background the whole time of this one character, Shibusawa, who's just, like, been manipulating things, and he's this manipulative little motherfucking piece of shit who's never, like, never gets his hands dirty kind of guy until he's, like, vying for power until finally you've managed to corner him and, like, force a confrontation. And then obviously he and Kiryu have this really big dramatic conversation about how they both have these incomplete dragon tattoos on their back because they're not, like, full Yakuza dudes yet or whatever, and so, like, they both rip their shirts off into the wind standing on this boat that's on fire and, like, expose their two dragon tattoos, and then they slam into each other, and then obviously, like, the awesome text comes up and the music is incredible. But the best part is, and this is where my award for this game comes through, is at the end of that boss fight, it begins a, like, quick time sequence of you beating the shit out of him because you finally beat him to submission, and it goes on for, like, 2 minutes of you just slapping the shit out of this guy, and then culminates in this just massive right hook, and the button prompt comes up at the bottom of the screen of this big triangle icon, and then above that is the subtitle, which is a giant text, and the subtitle is just Kiryu shouting, "Shibusawa!" And then he punches him full on in the face. So Yakuza Zero gets my Shibusawa award for most amazing fucking boss fights.
I can't wait to see if that ever comes back as an award.
It would have to be very fucking specific, because a game can only win that award if it has amazing boss fights, and if in one of those boss fights the climactic word spoken is Shibusawa. It's yelled at a high pitch.
Well, who knows? Yakuza 7 someday. Who knows?
Yeah.
All right. My number 3 game of the year. Again, Game of the Decade contender. Super Mario Odyssey for the Nintendo Switch. And Sean, I respect you. I understand why you gave Gravity Rush 2 the Most Delightful Game Award.
All right.
That belongs to fucking Mario. Because here's what Mario Odyssey has to offer up you. Is when you buy this game on Nintendo Switch, and you open the... If you buy it physically, and you open the case, the inside of the case, the inner insert, what they have, is the lyrics to a full, like, three-verse song that they wrote and recorded in both English and Japanese. And it's like a fucking CD. You open your game, and the words to that are there, and... I need to bring up the lyrics to that song because they are so amazing, and I just need to quote a couple of them.
Before you go on, I just want to point out in the defense of Gravity Rush 2, Gravity Rush 2 does have a full lyrical song. You don't get the lyrics to it because the lyrics are in fake Japanese French. So that's pretty delightful in my opinion.
That is pretty delightful too, but here's what you get with Super Mario Odyssey, is that that song on its own is just a fucking awesome thing, and I'd been listening to it before the game even came out because they put it out as a single and everything, and I was loving that song. It's called Jump Up Superstar. But in the middle of the game, roughly, you get to New Donk City, the Metro Kingdom, which is one of the best levels ever built for a video game. Inner tier. And when you complete like the main quest line there, the final thing you do in New Donk City is they're going to have a festival. You've done a bunch of objectives to help them do the festival. Part of that is you have to go find musicians playing throughout the city. And each time you add a musician to the main room, you slowly realize they are all jamming the original Super Mario Bros. Theme from the original game as like a jazz song. And it's fucking amazing. But then you start the main level, which is where you play this whole, like, linear platforming level across New Donk City while Mayor Pauline is standing on a roof singing this song. And it is one of the most joyous out-of-body experiences I have ever had playing a game. I love it so much. Let's read some of these lyrics, Sean.
All right.
So let's all jump up super high, high up in the sky. There's no power-up like dancing. That's a good one.
It's very true.
I love that. And if the dark clouds start to swirl, don't fear, don't shed a tear, because I'll be your one-up girl. That's just, I can't believe they did this. I love it. It's so great. Spin the wheel, take a chance. Every journey starts a new romance. Some of these rhymes, Sean.
Yeah.
They're so good. Take it in stride as you move side to side. They're just different points of view. Jump with me, grab coins with me. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And if you find you're short on joy, don't fret. Just don't forget that you're still our one-up boy. Really, these rhymes, man.
Yeah. So there's a commitment to it.
Here's the best verse. So go on, straighten up your cap. Let your toes begin to tap. This rhythm is a power shroom. Don't forget you're the superstar. No one else can make it this far. Put a comb through that stash. Now you've got panache. Oh, let's do the Odyssey. If it were just for that song and just for that moment, Mario Odyssey might still be in my top three because it is so good. And they did something so beautifully, gloriously silly with that song, and it is executed within the game itself so fucking perfectly. But around all of that, Mario Odyssey is maybe the best Mario game. And it is insane to me that it only ranks at number three,
right,
saying that, because Mario is maybe my favorite video game series. But Mario Odyssey is just a perfect game. And it's hard to even know what to say about it because literally, I don't think there's anything you could possibly point to as a problem with this game. And if you love Mario on any conceivable level, there are a million things for you in this game. Because it's actually one of the frustrations I had with a lot of the discourse around this game is everyone talking about, like, it's like Mario 64 again. And I think that does the game... It does this individual game and the series as a whole a huge disservice. Because one, you're basically saying everything since Mario 64 is crap, which is a really weird thing to say about a series of like 10 out of 10 rated games, you know? But it's also that Mario Odyssey, it has some structural similarities to Mario 64, but I think it's really smart about how it leverages Mario's entire history through all of this. Like, I understand the people who, you know, really want their Mario games to be, like, open world, you know, run around and do your own thing kind of games like Mario 64 was, and Mario Sunshine to a less successful extent. But I think, you know, most Mario design actually depends on linearity, and linearity is really important because that's how you build a sense of pace and progression and challenge in a game like this, specifically a platformer. And I think the most amazing thing Mario Odyssey does for me in a game design sense is how it blends the best of Mario's linear design and the best of Mario's non-linear design. And those big kingdoms you get to go and explore are just beautiful celebrations of those two kinds of gameplay. And they merge so perfectly, where you will get to go run around these worlds and explore and find all the things you want to find. But then when you stumble upon a real, like, platforming challenge, it'll really deftly, you know, seamlessly shift into something a little more linear, whether it's like a wall painting kind of thing where you literally go back to 8-bit, or there's a specific platform challenge room you fall into, or there's just a part of the world that is designed in a very, like, in a way that really pushes you through itself. And Mario Odyssey does those things with such aplomb, it's so seamless, and above all else, this game controls so buttery smooth, perfect. Like, it is the best controls Mario has ever had by far, and I think Mario tends to control pretty well, but this game just, it is so fun to just pick up the controller and manipulate Mario and do all the different jumps you can do. It is really a masterclass of every conceivable type of game design, for especially for this type of game. I could go on and on about it, and I feel like less is going to be more talking about Mario Odyssey. I love every kingdom in this game. My favorites are probably the Metro Kingdom, the Luncheon Kingdom, and the Seaside Kingdom. Those three just, I loved the most. I also love that this game, I think, has such a big, joyous, open heart. It's often a weird heart, because there's a lot of, like, weird experimental shit in this game where, like, the moment when Mario first possesses something in this game, if you haven't played the game, go watch it on YouTube when he first possesses a frog. Because it's not dissimilar to the movie Get Out and, like, what happens to, like, sure, when you go to the sunken place.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a lot less, you know, like, you know, thematically specific. But it's, like, it's a weirdly, like, it's like this surreal kind of visual thing they do. And I love how weird the game is. But it also just, it has such a great sense of fun and joy and happiness that permeates absolutely everything in the game. And also a sense of surprise, because this game just keeps surprising you to the very, very end. And I can confidently say, the saddest I think I was playing a video game all year was when I 100%ed Mario Odyssey and realized there wasn't any more to play. Like, I poured 60 hours into this game, I achieved 100% of what you could do, I got every single Power Moon, I got every costume, I bought every extra Power Moon you can buy, and I got to the end and it was just, I want to keep playing. I want there to be more. This game is huge and there's not enough of it. And how rare a feeling is that for a game this big? It's kind of what you said about Yakuza 0. You'd play it all over again. And it's just like, I cannot wait for the DLC for Mario Odyssey because, you know, while this game has some comparisons to open world games, it's not really the kind of game you can go back in and keep playing when you've already done everything, because there's, like, nothing left to kind of find in the game. But man, I had so much fun with this, and I was so sad when I realized there was no more to play. And I just think it's one of the great achievements in video games ever, and Nintendo did it several times this year. So, Mario Odyssey, reason enough to buy a Switch. I love this game.
Awesome.
Also, they rhymed stash with panache. I feel like I need to remind everyone of that.
It's very good. And it reminds you also that Mario does have such a lustrous stash that one needs to put a comb through it, you know?
Yeah.
He maintains that stash. He doesn't just have it. Like, it's a specific fashion choice.
Also, remember going into 2017, we didn't know what Mario's naked chest looked like. Coming out of 2017...
You maybe didn't. I definitely did.
We know, and he is shaved like a baby, which is weird.
He has the body of a toddler. That is definitely true. I mean, if nothing else, Super Mario Odyssey has raised a lot of, like, really fundamental questions about things we've assumed for a long, long time about the nature of Mario in the world he lives in. Because Mario, not fucking human, turns out. He's not a human, because there are other humans there that look like humans, and Mario doesn't look like them.
Yeah. He's so good. All right, that's my number three. Number two, Sean.
Oh,
let's do our number twos.
Oh, Jesus. So, yeah, number two and number one were, like, I basically cheated in my reasoning for why I took an easy out for why this game is at number two. It'll be obvious, like, once I start making that obvious how it's an easy out. But my number two game of the year for 2017 is Persona 5. because it wins my 2017's 2016 Game of the Year award, because this is a 2016 game to me, and I cannot break that mindset of it. It is, I mean, I don't even know if I need to say anything, because Jonathan, do you know off the top of your head how long we spent talking about Persona 5 on this podcast?
I do, because I assembled a podcast, and it's 10.5 hours long.
So yes, there is literally 10.5 hours. There's almost, you could almost spend half of an entire actual day in literal contiguous time just listening to our thoughts about Persona 5. So I'll try to be somewhat brief in summing up my thoughts. But first I need to address why it's at number 2, because there is still a part of me that feels like maybe it should be number 1. But like the clinching factor is for me, like, the number 1 game of the year is not just the best game of the year, but it's also the game of the year that defines that year for games for me. Like, and that's like one of the ways I approach it, and like, and how I know what feels right as number 1.
And I like that. I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, as much as, you know, we talked a lot about Persona 5, and like Persona 5 dominated a lot of our lives, obviously, in this year, but that was review for me, because, you know, for those who, you know, maybe miss a lot of this stuff and don't realize, I played Persona 5 in Japanese last year in October when it came out in Japan last year. And there's a part of Persona 5 that for me is so wrapped up in that experience, because it was also sort of a personal culmination in a lot of ways for me of that journey of learning another language. Because, you know, I had taken like some Spanish classes in high school, some like French classes, and like sort of played around with other languages before it's taking Japanese classes in college, but it never quite stuck. And then that, like, whatever it was, like with Japanese, it interested me, like it's like the culture and the style of the language and all that stuff, and then learning an entirely different writing system, all that stuff absorbed me in such a way that I really committed a lot of my life and my time in the past couple of years mastering that language. And a huge step in that for me is and was like playing through Persona 5 entirely in Japanese and taking that step and like dedicating that, like, was an exorbitant amount of time. This is another game. This is not a game I spent over 100 hours playing. This is a game I can prove to you, spent over 200 hours playing, because this is one of the recipients this year of a game that wins my A Game So Nice I Played It Twice award. It's just, I only played it once this year, but I played it twice if you count when I played it in Japanese.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, so that's sort of my reasoning of why it's at number 2, is that, like, it is a big game for this year, but it is also, like, so tied to me of also just, like, that moment in time for me of that, like, leading up to the Trump election and all that stuff, and that's obviously very relevant to the themes of the game. So to make the briefest argument I possibly can for the merits of Persona 5, it is a game that has, even before you get to talking about like specifics of the story and the themes, it is a game that has the best style. Like, if you're talking about fucking panache, like, that's, here we go. Here's another new award for Persona 5. Best and most panache award goes to Persona 5, because it doesn't just have the best panache, it also has the most panache, because the visual style and aesthetic of this game is so powerful, so consistent, so creative, so brilliant, that spurs and shines through in every single frame of this game, and every single thought expressed in this game, and every single note on the soundtrack that is one of the three just like incomparably incredible soundtracks in games this year, alongside Gravity Rush 2 and the next game we'll talk about on my list. Everything about the panache and style and aesthetic of this game is so pure, raw, and creative. But it's not just that, because it is also all about expressing the core ideas of the story and these ideas that are in these themes that are so pertinent and relevant and powerful, and I think expressed really powerfully about modern society and specifically modern Japanese society and the issues that it faces. Like, it's not quite as specifically Marxist as Gravity Rush 2 is, so it doesn't quite win the Best Marxist Game Award, but it is just as socially conscious, I think, as Gravity Rush 2 was, and doesn't even sort of try to couch its social consciousness in metaphor. Like, there's a little bit of that in, like, the designs of the monsters or something, but it, like, is directly dealing with issues of love labor issues and issues of gender, issues of sexuality, and the issues of representation and democracy and power in society. And it approaches all of that stuff with the keen intellect and the kind of keen intellect one would expect of this team, the keen intellect and like incisive creativity that they use to approach themes of mortality and identity in Persona 3 and Persona 4. And Persona 5 is the product of that team and of the brilliance of that team. and the narrative insight and like creative insight of that team. And it has provided me some of my most like memorable experiences in games, some of the most memorable characters and lines of dialogue and performances. Morgana, the cat, is just one of my favorite characters in anything. And I think what that cat does and that the journey that that cat goes on and how that cat is with you through thick and thin is just so brilliant and beautiful. And the notes in some of the concluding cutscenes that Morgana expresses to you about the themes of the game, I this is another in like the trilogy of games on my list dealing with mundanity of Gravity Rush 2, Yakuza 0, and Persona 5 is obviously this is the whole component of the game of going to school and going to town and living your life and just fun, beautiful, weird, crazy things like going and buying or renting a DVD for the X folder and then going home and on a rainy night watching it with your cat buddy and getting to hear, you know, playing the Japanese version, like funny, weird Japanese dialogue that's like an approximation of like cliche dialogue from the X-Files. And again, like tied into my experience playing it in Japanese, like having to sort of piece that together, that's what it is, that like that's what that dialogue is like the Japanese version of like the stupid shit that Mulder says all the time on the X-Files is like was for me personally a very just like beautiful moment. And all the characters, the whole cast of characters, everybody, you know, from Ryuji to Morgana to Futaba and Anne and like all those main characters, all your social link characters and the stories that they go through, like the Kawakami sensei and all of them and like Otani and all those characters are brilliant and they all contribute to the main themes. But then it is culminated for me in the final moments of the game and the final message and imagery and ideas and notes of the soundtrack that the game leads you on of this idea of part of growing up is finding these like complex, nuanced and politically motivated ways to change society that is more than just you get to go into people's hearts and minds and change them with magic bullshit. It is about like starting grassroots movements to stop, you know, like issues with law enforcement and them like illegal like or like kind of like pressuring you into prison and things like that for crimes that you like didn't really commit and banding together as a group and finding solace as a group in this like very divided like soulless like sort of fractured world that we live in that's dominated by social media and dominated by all these voices that this cacophony of voices that we are, our identities and ourselves are drowned in, and we can't find ourselves and can't find our feet and can't find our motivation in this world to go forward and push forward. And the message this game gives you, there's a message that, you know, is true for the entire Persona franchise, but I think in some ways it feels most powerful here because it is most rooted in real world issues here, is that how you find your feet and how you find your power and how you find your influence in this world is by finding the people around you that you care about and holding on and pushing forward together as a team and as a united consciousness. And that's the sort of the quiet denouement that this game ends on, and the final imagery that this game expresses to punctuate that point, I think, is beautiful and incredible and insightful. And in many ways, it's the best game of the year, but it is absolutely was my number zero absolute best game from last year that gets to be on the list this year because it also gets the Best Podcast Game Award because for 10 and a half hours of podcast. Not the best game to listen to podcast to, the best game to record podcast to.
It's at least the most podcast award.
It is the best and most podcast game award. There we go. That is my number two.
Well, Sean, I just have to say, I am shocked and disappointed in you that you would put Persona 5 as only the second best game of the year. Anyway, my number two is Persona 5.
Yeah, you don't even have an excuse.
No, I have an excuse. Persona 5 is a brilliant game. Also my number two. This is weirdly our only point of sync on the list.
Yeah.
Is the game everyone probably assumed would be our number ones this year. I'm going to read some of what I wrote, because there are so many directions we could go in with Persona 5, and Sean...
And we went in all of them already.
We went in all of them already. Sean, you just talked about a lot of it, and I agree with everything you just said. Here's what I wrote for Persona 5, though, trying to distill it into just a couple of paragraphs. I'm not going to read all of this, but some of it. Persona 5 is a profound act of alchemy. It is a game that takes a pointed sense of outrage, a distilled and pure and deeply felt anger, and over the course of 100 hours of expertly interwoven story and gameplay, transforms that rage into beauty and into transcendence. No game this year, heck, no game this decade, has its finger on the pulse of our times like Persona 5. It harnesses the fury we feel towards our deeply broken world, a world where liars prosper, goodness comes at a cost, and those most in need of a voice are frequently the first to be silenced, and tells us that those feelings are real, that they matter, and that we should hold our anger close to our heart and let that flame burn bright. And then it tells us to get the fuck out there and do something about it. It tells us that it is possible to imagine and to actualize a better future, a better tomorrow, a better today. And by the end of its campaign, it makes the allure of that seemingly simple possibility, the possibility of having a fighting chance towards charting one's own unique, fulfilling path, feel like the most powerful, inspiring, and liberating thing in the world. That it does all this on top of the most refined, accomplished, multi-layered, and complicated yet elegant RPG system ever created for a video game is something that's almost easy to take for granted. Yet Persona 5 is awash in engaging, expertly balanced, perfectly realized gameplay systems, and even more so than its wonderful predecessors, it works overtime to ensure that every single thing a player can possibly do in some way furthers the story, deepens the world, enhances the sense of atmosphere, or most importantly, brings one closer to the incredible cast of characters. The number of superlatives one could hang on Persona 5 is almost overwhelming. Its writing, performances in English or Japanese, art style, and especially Shoji Meguro's bass-driven musical score rank among the greatest accomplishments ever attained in this medium. Be it games, movies, TV, music, painting, few works of art reach as high as Persona 5 does, and fewer still attain everything they set out to grasp. It is to this rarefied class of masterpieces that Persona 5 belongs. I think that's pretty good for three paragraphs.
Yes.
That was a hard one.
I'm glad you touched on some of the gameplay stuff, because that was something I forgot to mention. Is also the combat's fucking awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's fucking great.
Also, some of the best boss fights of any game this year. Yep. This has been a very good year for games and boss fights, turns out.
Weirdly, yes.
Yeah.
And I'm not a boss fight fan, but there are a lot of games on this list with great... I forgot to mention that for Metroid Samus Returns. Great boss fights.
Yeah.
A lot of them this year.
Yeah.
All right, so Sean, moment of truth. We're going to list our number ones.
Yeah.
So, Sean.
Yes.
You have the honor. What is your number one game of the year, my friend?
My number one game of the year. Probably people have figured it out through the process of deduction at this point, or they have not been paying close attention. My number one game of the year, my defining game of the year for 2017 is Nier Automata. Of course it is, because it gets my "Where the fuck did this thing come from?" award. Because Jonathan, where the fuck did this thing come from? It is absurd. I know I've said that about a couple of games on this list. Yakuza 0. Persona 5 is absurd in some places. Yakuza 0 is very absurd in some places. And Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus, is extremely absurd in some places. Nier Automata, the very existence of this game is absurdity itself. It has no business being as amazing as it is, and it took me so aback immediately. It is just... it's almost impossible to know what to say about it, because also I don't want to spoil anything about it. The first thing I'll start to say about it is that, you know, it's very, very hard to try to even approach applying auteur theory to video games because of, like, the absurd number of people, particularly today, that have to work on it. And then also I think sometimes it's hard to deduce in video games where, like, a creative voice can shine through all the time. But I think it's fair enough to say... that Nier Automata, if you're going to apply a game that has, like, more than, like, a dozen people working on it, like, auteur theory, Nier Automata is where you go, because this is the product of a man named Yoko Taro, who is just fucking brilliant. And to demonstrate that point, I'm going to read something that has nothing to do with Nier Automata. But on December 11th, a man named Joel Couture from Gama Sutra put together this feature called "What Devs Are Saying About the Design of Animal Crossing Pocket Camp," which is the mobile Animal Crossing game that came out very recently. And Gama Sutra does this feature every now and again for different games of, like, asking developers, like, what their ideas are. Like, here, I'll just read, like, one of his introductory paragraphs is, "To get a better sense of how the game is going over with devs around the industry and what bits of Pocket Camp stand out to them for better and for worse, Gama Sutra reached out and asked, 'What do you think about that new mobile Animal Crossing?'" And the first on the list, developers they asked, was Yoko Taro, developer of Nier Automata. And so I'm now going to read to you in entirety his response to this question of, "What did you think of Animal Crossing Pocket Camp?" Are you ready, Jonathan?
My body is ready.
All right. Yoko Taro. I played the 3DS Animal Crossing. And you know the raccoon who makes you get a mortgage without agreeing to it? It was like the Lemon Shock, the bankruptcy of Lemon Brothers. So I wanted to get revenge on him in the mobile version. I was kind of sad because there are fewer things you can do in the mobile app compared to the 3DS version. The fact that you have less freedom makes the Ditch Forest seem even darker. Let's take, for example, what the monsters eat. The rabbit seems to be of the normal herbivorous variety, but can be seen in this game, grilling and eating fish. Also in this game, pigs and cows enjoy barbecue, but you can't see what they're grilling. What is going on in this ecosystem? When you run out of things to eat, do you resort to cannibalism? Is there so much difference in the intelligence of birds and fish? If you walk on two legs and talk, does that mean you won't be hunted? Is the value of your life determined by your intelligence? There's so many interesting themes hidden in this game. Also, I want to say something about the unreasonable shopping. You need to predict what those monsters want, like a human who possesses telepathy, and give those things to them to get your big reward. What is this a metaphor for? Why do you have to collect things that are right next to the monsters to make them happy, like a slave? I guess this represents the divisions between people and class society. I haven't put any furniture or anything in my camp except a kerosene tank. I started this game to get revenge on that raccoon, Tom Nook. But now, I have a different purpose. I'll enjoy playing this game until I burn that dark forest down.
That is definitely the guy who made Nier Automata.
Yes, that is is the value of your life determined by your intelligence? There are so many interesting themes hidden in this game. The fact that you could fucking say that about the mobile version of an Animal Crossing game, that's what he pulls from it. That there's a part of this that he says, I guess this represents the divisions between people and class society. How did you do that, Yoko Taro? Like, what fucking crazy shit are you on, man? That's like where your brain goes with Animal Crossing. And that's the mind that produces Nier Automata, which is a game that delivers, I think, one of the most accomplished, rich, and sophisticated narratives I've ever seen in any medium I've ever engaged with. And that's like straight up. Like, that's straight fucking up. I think it is one of the most remarkable things done in the genre of tragedy, which is arguably the oldest genre that exists in fiction to have happened in probably like hundreds of years. It is what he does with, and him and his team do with the video game medium to try to express these really complicated ideas about identity, about like the nature of intelligence, the nature of human life, and our relationship to like so many things. Like, there's so many themes because it's such a rich, dense text. So it's about our relationship towards our technology, our relationship towards ourself, our relationship with like our idea of the human and our valuing of the human, and an analysis of, is there any value in that? Like, is there any value in these androids like seeking this idea of the human? Like, what does that even mean? And that's a kind of idea that you can say lots of different sort of android-based like science fiction texts engage with, but nothing engages with that idea in the way that Nier Automata does. And nothing goes as deep I've ever seen as Nier Automata does. It is a truly brilliant, remarkable, like it feels to me like a work of genius, which is not something I would often say about anything. It obviously there, as with all the best things, it is extremely flawed in a number of different ways that it is impossible to deny, but in so many ways the flaws of the thing make it what it is to me in such a way that I cannot see them as flaws anymore. I can understand them and recognize them in an abstract sense as a flaw, but like the like, you know, Route B being as long as it is, it needs to be as long as it is, because if it wasn't, it wouldn't be Nier Automata anymore. Like the combat being, you know, like the combat mechanics being somewhat shallow, it's like it needs to be shallow, because if they were really deep combat mechanics, it wouldn't be Nier Automata anymore. Like it's such a pure expression and it's such a pure thing to me that I cannot remove anything from the game and still call it what it is. I cannot even like being able to intellectualize some of these qualities as flaws, say that were this thing to be refined or this thing to be removed or something to be added, that would actually improve the game in any way, because it would no longer be the game that it is. And it's a thing that I can't often say about anything, because it's the thing about Nier Automata is engaging with it makes me feel like I'm engaging with like the Odyssey or The Canterbury Tales, or King Lear, you know, or like Ulysses by James Joyce. Like, it's like, for me to equate something to Nier Automata is me to equate to some of the greatest works of fiction that have ever been produced, because the greatest works of fiction that have been produced as of now are pieces of literature, because that's what's been going on for the longest amount of time. And Nier Automata, I'm not like, you know, it'd be absurd to try to like rank those things next to each other, but that's what this game inspired, that mindset in me, in a way that like I think the Persona games can do in moments, but Nier Automata does in such a way it's kind of hard to express, that I've never quite seen before. And some of that is how just jaw-dropping, amazing the ending of the game is, and like the full culmination of the ideas around tragedy and like togetherness, and the way it uses the video game medium to express those ideas and to connect you to people to try to sort of work through this cumulative tragedy you've experienced in playing through the game. A lot of the ideas expressed in the side quests I think are brilliant. This is another game that gets the Game I So Nice I Played It Twice award, because, and this is not just like played it 1 year, played it the next year. This is, I finished Nier Automata, and then I started Nier Automata again and did a full 100% playthrough of Nier Automata with like the full DLC and like the weird music video at the end of the DLC and all that stuff, because I needed, like, personally as a person and as like a member of academia in some way, felt obliged to do that to this game, because it called me to treat it to that like extreme and that extent. You know, I've read so much of the writing around this game because I think it inspires brilliant writing. I've listened to a lot of the conversations around this game in podcasts because I think it inspires brilliant conversations. Like, obviously you can go and listen to our spoiler like filled podcast if you played the game.
I think that was a good one.
Yes, I think that was a good one, because there's so much that, and like even that in some ways only scratched the surface of a lot of the things that you can talk about. Like, it's just, the writing is so sharp. I think the dialogue is so sharp. The performances in Japanese, particularly from 2B and 9S, are just absolutely fucking incredible. And some of the most remarkable moments of the game are also ones that are like hidden in weird corners behind like secret boss fights and stuff. But it is like brilliant. And just I think, and more than anything else, like even beyond like those like brilliant sort of inciting moments of like the stronger themes across the game, is just the larger sort of tone and atmosphere of Nier Automata. And that's the place where I feel like, you know, I can see people arguing about like trying to trim some of the fat off the game, but also like you need that fat to just exist in and breathe in that world, because it's so just rich and dripping with atmosphere and that like incredibly rich textured melancholy that is the game, of this world that is, it's not a post-apocalypse. This has been, it's 10,000 years or something past the apocalypse. This world is so far beyond the world where humans even like lived in. And that scale of time and that sense of hopeless desperation that exists there, where you live in this world where humans have been extinct for 10,000 years, but everything that's left on this planet is desperately trying to approach the human, but none of them even know what that means anymore. Like, that aesthetic and that sensation is something I don't think anything else has ever accomplished to the degree that Nier Automata has. This is also the third and last game on my list of the like trinity of amazing fucking video game soundtracks this year. I listen to the Nier Automata soundtrack all the time. I think that soundtrack has such a brilliantly unique aesthetic. I've never heard a soundtrack like it. The only other one I know of that is like it is the soundtrack to the original Nier, so that's appropriate. But like the quality of the sound and like what they're going for is just like, there's nothing that sounds like it.
My brother played this game recently and also loved it a lot, like you do. And he's a composer, and he will not shut up about the Nier Automata soundtrack.
It's so good.
And I mean, as a like, you know, musician, he is really in awe of it.
Yeah, and like what it does with, like, one of my favorite things about it is it has a number of different sort of like vocalists in it, but there's like three core vocalists, one of whom sings in English, one of whom sings in Japanese, and one in whom sings in the second Japanese version of French that is on this list. There's another one that's a Gravigross 2 that's like a fake French from like a Japanese perspective.
Quick, which has a better fake French?
Gravigross 2. It has to be Gravigross 2. I mean, it's
more central to that game.
Yes. But yeah, with Nier Automata, it has those three different languages. I think this game is very interested in language, which is something that's interesting to me because I speak the two languages that this, like the two actual world languages that this game deals with. And I think, God, there's so much like interesting stuff you can get into with like the differences between the English and Japanese text, and how it is playing with some of that stuff, because I think there's like intentional, like, I actually like intentional story differences between some of the, how some of those characters approach things, and how, like, some of the dialogue in certain lines of text in the game are so, like, specific to the word that they convey different things in different languages that, like, unveil different layers to, I think, what the game is getting at. And just, like, everything about the game is so, so brilliant. It's so amazing. It gets my most revolutionary game award, was the best word I could come up with this game for this game, is revolutionary. That's what it just feels like to me, is that it, like, revolutionizes a lot of, like, assumptions I made about how games can communicate story, how games can communicate tone, like, and just, like, what a video game can be and what a video game can, like, express to me and make me feel. Like I responded to this game in such an absurdly powerful way. And then the last note I want to leave on is an incredibly trivial one, is that the animations are really fucking good in this game. Like, absurdly good. And I think it's one of the most underappreciated things about the game, because to appreciate the animations, you just have to go find an empty field, stand still, and just do some of the attack animations and all the different combinations, and just bask in the detail and the high frame rate and just the love and care that went into every single frame of animation in this game, because it has the best, like, weapon animations I've ever seen. It has the incredibly specific animations, different animations to sort of go return to a neutral state from any different sort of position you're in. That is so beautifully detailed, and it shows that I think, like, every single fiber of this game has an immense amount of, like, heart and emotion and intellect driven into it to deliver its overall message. And one of those is the animation that I like a lot.
Near Automata for me, I should just say, finished outside of the top 10 for me. It's not on my top 10. It's in my top 15 to 20. Or no, it's actually in the top 15. We'll get to my other rankings in a minute. But I just wanted to say, like, before I reveal my number one, I actually like where our number ones took us.
Yes.
Hearing to you.
I also like that I'm assuming what your number one is, that your number one is not on my list and my number one is not on your list.
That's never happened before. That's kind of fascinating. Yeah. Cause last year, like, your number one wasn't on mine, but we both had Digimon stories.
Yeah.
So anyway, but what I was going to say is that, Sean, like, I've loved listening to you talk about Nier all year. Like, it did not resonate with me the same way it did with you. And that's cool. Like, that's a thing about... That's why we do this podcast and why it's two of us, you know?
Yeah.
And we can have these conversations because Nier so clearly resonates something really fundamental in you. And I think when I hear you talk about all the, like, academic things you bring in to think about Nier, and your different, like, fields of scholarship that you go after... And I love hearing that it resonates with all those things, and it feels like a very fundamental work to maybe even bring some of that into light for you of, like, what you really value. And I say that as a preamble to, that is how I would define my number one game for me, and this also kind of shows the places where we are different in what we look at in visual art, even though we love, obviously, a lot of the same things. No disagreement among us on Doctor Who or anything.
Yeah.
My number one game of the year is The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. For the Nintendo Switch and Wii U. And this is a game that is so close to my heart at this point. It just feels like a part of me. And it is so defining and has helped throw into relief for me the things I value in visual art. And I think Breath of the Wild is nothing if not one of the most significant pieces of visual art I have encountered in my lifetime. So to kind of follow the outline of what I wrote about this game, because this game took me a long time to try to summarize verbally. This is the game I've played the most this year. I've banked more than 150 hours in it. I don't know what the count even is at this point. The last couple days I've spent playing this game, I'm on the motorcycle from the DLC, which I forgot to mention on the Tuesday podcast, and I feel bad because that motorcycle is fucking amazing. And I've got the motorcycle, and I got my Korok mask on, and I'm just riding on top of mountains and shit, and waiting for the Korok mask to go off, and it's the most ridiculous fucking thing that they added basically like a GTA motorcycle into Zelda, but it's so fun. And I just, that's a preamble of saying, like, my thoughts on this have only, like, you know, solidified the more I continue to play this game, seemingly never ending for me. And the word I use and keep coming back to with The Legend of Zelda is a word I use in my own scholarship a lot, which is sublime. And I actually used this as a central thesis of a lecture I gave at CU last month on the film Spirited Away by Hayao Miyazaki. Hayao Miyazaki's work obviously sharing more than a little DNA with The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild and its art style. And sublime is a word we misuse a lot of the time. We use it as like, oh, that chocolate cake was sublime.
Right.
That's not what that word means. Like, I get your intent. That word has a really specific meaning, and the place I take it from often is the writer Edmund Burke from the 1700s. His treatise, A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of the Sublime and Beautiful, I quote a lot in my own work. And he defines the sublime as a beauty so astonishing and absolute that its presence consumes our physical and mental bodies with a state of the purest awe. In doing this, he broke with classical and Greek aesthetic theory in asserting that the deepest meaning of an encounter with the sublime can be just the experience in and of itself, and it need not lead us to a concrete intellectual revelation, which is what, like, the Greeks would say about beauty. It can have a deep existential impact on our minds and our beings just by that encounter. And when I use the word sublime, I use it in this sense, and I don't use it lightly, because I feel it is an effective way to describe a meaningful aesthetic encounter, an encounter so meaningful, in fact, that it can be really difficult to put into words, because the most powerful aesthetic experiences are, by their very nature, intensely nonverbal. And I think more than any other video game ever made, it's this notion of the sublime that The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild taps into, minimizing, though in no way erasing, linear narrative and overt characterization to make its aesthetic, palpable, interactive world the thing itself. Those vast open distances, those endlessly beautiful sights, and especially on one's, you know, first playthrough, that constant sense of discovery serving as the most fundamental point of the experience. Edmund Burke has this whole quote I love about infinity as a powerful aspect of the sublime, and he asserts that infinity is something that kind of fills us with this delightful horror and that we can't comprehend it, even though there are very few things that, as he says, can become the object of our senses that are actually infinite. Like, the infinite is not something we actually can just see and point to a lot of the time. But if you can't see the bounds of it and you can't understand the underlying nature of it, they seem to be infinite, and they produce the same effects. And his definition rings true to me when you climb out of the Shrine of Resurrection at the beginning of this game and see that boundless world laid out before you. Or when you first realize that that mountain far off upon the horizon that has caught your eye can be reached and climbed and conquered. Or when you first download a map segment and see that this big, beautiful, wondrous plateau you started on is only this tiny sliver of the larger world that awaits. And that idea continues to ring true for me the second, the fifth, the tenth, the 20th time you do these things, and even beyond that, in an endless permutation of visual and experiential wonder. And that's why Breath of the Wild makes me feel the sublime. It's not the most graphically or technologically advanced game ever made, even this year, even on this list, even on your list, but it is, to my eyes, far and away the most beautiful game I have ever played. Its employment of rich and varied color, dramatic and dynamic light, swaying grass and textured painterly landscapes, all of which evoke the greatest traditions of Japanese painting, of Japanese animation, but all of this in a world that feels fleshed out, tangible, lived in, and yes, infinite. The sublime is felt almost constantly in this game, and not a facsimile of it, nor even a good artistic representation, but a genuine experience of it, of something so much bigger and more awe-inspiringly beautiful than one can even comprehend. All forms of art can touch upon this from time to time, but games, being interactive, have a unique, yet often, I think, in their never-ending search for visual realism, underused opportunity to incorporate these ideas into their being. And so for Breath of the Wild, the feelings associated with the sublime are the seed from which the entire game grows. And I think it's a game I love so much because it could only exist at a game. It is unadaptable to any other medium, not just because the story is minimal, but because its truest, purest stories are the ones you experience while moving through the world at your own pace, upon your own whims. It's a purely experiential work of art, something that cannot be precisely recreated even between individual players, and that's a kind of magic only video games can conjure. The title itself, Breath of the Wild, is such a lovely signal of this mission statement to me. You know, most Zelda series titles are in one way or another a comment on the story, so like The Wind Waker or The Ocarina of Time, it's an object, a MacGuffin in the story. Or you've got characters like The Twilight Princess or The Oracle of Seasons. But Breath of the Wild is a phrase that evokes what the player experiences and feels while moving through its world. Nintendo has lovingly crafted a landscape tailor-made for adventure, gifted us with all the necessary tools and gameplay systems we need, and set us loose to have that adventure in an intensely personal, thoroughly unique way. And I could talk about all the, you know, great mechanical things I think the game does. I love that it is this complex but intuitive mixture of a concentrated number of gameplay elements and systems that even 150 hours in can still interact in surprising and challenging and consistently rewarding ways. And nearly all parts of the world are in some way a puzzle. Curiosity will always prove rewarding. I love that a search for just a shrine, one of the main things in the game, can involve all the forms of movement, walking, running, horseback riding, motorcycle riding now, environmental puzzles, all of those things. And once you get there, you're rewarded with these amazing 3D puzzle rooms, which I'd forgotten how much I fucking enjoyed until the DLC came out, and I got to play a bunch of new ones. Those are so good. The four divine beasts, this game's variation on the traditional dungeon structure, I think are even better. These grand symphonies in comparison to the shrines, pleasing intermezzos. Your exploration also can uncover Koroks, this nearly never-ending series of environmental puzzles that definitely appear in more forms than you are aware of, and I know this because I have like 500 now, and I'm still finding new ways to find them. You know, in almost all cases, no matter what you do in this game, you'll be rewarded with a little something, a heart piece, a stamina piece, a Korok seed, a weapon, a shield, some rupees, that will empower you for the next encounter. But sometimes, and this is one of the most key points in why I love this game, sometimes it won't reward you with anything. Sometimes the reward for getting to the top of that hill, for figuring out the best way to climb or traverse that great and complicated distance, the reward might just be the experience itself. It might just be the view you get to gaze upon. And that, to me, is in its own way quietly radical. Throughout the 2000s, you know, my lifetime covering games, we've been inundated with open worlds that strive to give us more. More gameplay systems, more progression rewards, more map icons, more side quests, more indicators on the screen, more dialogue, more story, more distractions in a lot of cases. And Breath of the Wild has the audacity to suggest that more might in fact be less. That silence and stillness, openness and evocation, freedom and exploration might be more powerful motivators for the player than a constant, ever-present, overbearing guiding hand. And it has enough confidence in its own aesthetics to know that the reward might just be the experience itself. And much as I have strived here to do so, it's still difficult to put into words what Breath of the Wild achieves for me. What this game goes for, I think, goes beyond definition, beyond the boundaries of the verbally reducible. And it achieves these aims in such consistently stunning fashion, and that makes it, to me, just an artistic miracle. As I said, I think it's one of the greatest and most significant works of visual art in my lifetime, and as someone who has been called in my own work before something of an aestheticist, it is a game that, like, again, helps me understand what it is I'm drawn to in visual art, and on top of just being a fun, wonderful, beautiful game. And I love this thing. I love it exists. It's also defining for me in 2017 in that this was the launch game for the Nintendo Switch. It's a game I've had all year on this platform that I've had all year that I played more than I was probably even expecting to, because the Switch turned out to be such a wonderful, pleasant surprise. And that's another reason it just feels right to me at number one, is it so helps define my year in gaming. But that is my long way of saying that The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild is my number one game of the year. Our number ones are not that similar.
No, but
except in the ways they kind of are.
They kind of are. Like I think everything you're saying about like what this is and what it expresses can only be expressed in like this interactive and like directly engaged way is so true about both Legend of Zelda and Nier Automata. Like more true than it is for most games.
Yep. All right. Well, that is the top 10 games of 2017.
Yes.
Okay, so Sean, before we move on and do all our honorable mentions and wrap-up stuff, you want to do a quick recap of the lists?
It is traditional to do so.
All right. Your number 10 was?
My number 10 game of the year was Uncharted: The Lost Legacy.
My number 10 was Gravity Rush 2.
My number 9 was Hatsune Miku: Project Diva Future Tone.
It really dominated this podcast in unexpected ways.
Yes, it did. And it will continue to do so in the future if I have anything to say about it.
Number 9 is Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle.
Number 8 is Sonic Mania.
My number 8 is Uncharted: The Lost Legacy.
My number 7 is Horizon Zero Dawn.
My number 7 is Sonic Mania.
My number 6 is Nioh.
My number 6 is Fire Emblem Echoes: Shadows of Valentia.
My number 5 is Wolfenstein 2: The New Colossus.
My number 5 is Metroid: Samus Returns.
My number 4 is Gravity Rush 2.
My number 4 is Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice.
My number 3 is Yakuza 0.
My number 3 is Super Mario Odyssey.
My number 2 is Persona 5.
My number 2 is Persona 5.
And my number 1, in my opinion, the best game of 2017, and my most favorite game of 2017, is Nier Automata.
My number 1, favorite of the year, one of my favorites ever, is number 1, The Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild.
There you go.
All right. Well, that was fun.
Yes.
A lot of good games this year.
Yeah, like especially once you get into that upper echelon, like the top 3. This is a good fucking video game, Jonathan.
Yep. I think this is the second year in a row where we've had exactly 4 crossover games between our 2 lists.
Yeah.
We divided and conquered again.
Yep.
Yep. All right. So how do you want to do some honorable mention chat?
So I have 3 games that I put in for my honorable mentions. I know you did put together a whole little list. So you want me to just sort of go through my 3?
Yeah, go through your 3, and mine will be quick. I have like a sentence on each. But yeah,
because I also just have a couple of some supplemental awards. My first honorable mention, I'll go with Tacoma, which gets my Best Space Proles Award, the Space Proletariat. Because, you know, I think that game had some issues, I think, in how it dealt with capitalism in the sort of, like, concluding acts, which is one of the main reasons it's not on my top 10, but I do like that it, like, attacked those themes, and the characters they sketched out were so compelling and interesting that I thought, like, that deserves mention. It also gets the Best Picking Shit Up Off the Ground and Staring at It Award, because, boy, that game has a lot of really nice high-resolution textures on, like, cups and stuff that you can just stare at for hours. That's one of my honorable mentions.
Well-earned awards, I think.
Yes, very well-earned. Another one of my honorable mentions is Destiny 2. Destiny 2 was, like, the one that, like, that could be my number 10. I'm not that passionate about it, but I think ultimately Uncharted Lost Legacy edges over it for me. Destiny 2 gets the Lost in the Jumble Award, which is kind of why I think it didn't make my list, is that there's just so much shit going on, and, like, I just fell off of Destiny 2 and just didn't end up ever going back to it. So.
Kind of crazy that one completely absent from either list.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes complete sense, but like going into this year, I don't know if you'd have expected it.
Yeah. It also gets the Best Podcast Game Award, different from the Persona 5 Best Podcast Game Award, which is for recording podcasts. This is for listening to podcasts and playing the game.
Yes.
It's a different. And then the last one I'm going to give for Destiny 2 is the I'm probably just going to play the shit out of this game in 2018 award, which is like, that's probably how that's going to work out. This is going to be some piece of DLC that comes out for it next year, and it'll be on like a special award for my Game of the Year list next year.
Or the
way
DLC,
that Destiny 1 was.
Or the DLC for Destiny 2 will be markedly better, and it will earn a spot on the top 10. Whatever its equivalent of the Taken
King
is.
Sure, yes. Or it'll have a Taken King version of it. Yeah. There's that. And then the last one is a game that you already talked beautifully about, is Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which did not make my list. And it gets the longest award, which is the Metal Gear Solid 5 and Final Fantasy 15 presents the 2018. This game is really fucking good in so many ways, but there's something about it deep in its core that just doesn't fucking work for me. Award. Which is, it's 3 years in a row now where there is a game that, for me, like, there's so many things about it that I think are absolutely singular and remarkable and kind of like best in class in so many ways, but where it fails for me, it fails in such a critical way that, like, I can't, like, justify putting it on the list. First was 2015's Metal Gear Solid 5, which we talked a lot about on this podcast. Then it was Final Fantasy 15, which, like, also, like, just had, like, the issues that the game had, and I, like, just couldn't justify it. It did win Miyuki Sawashiro's Award for Peculiar Excellence, so I did feel like I gave it its due. And then, yeah, just, like, you know, we talked a lot about Breath of the Wild on our big spoiler cast, and for me, it's just, like, the things that the game is trying to evoke, for me specifically, I think it's just, like, calibrated improperly for me, is what it ultimately feels like.
Yeah. I hope the Miyuki Sawashiro Award can be an annual thing.
I wasn't planning on it being, but it's entirely possible.
She is prolific enough.
She does enough. Like,
and she's only 32, so like she has plenty of time left.
Unfortunately, I don't think she plays anybody in Dragon Ball, so like that would be one of the main vectors would be like Dragon Ball Fighters, but I don't think she does.
We'll see. You know what? There will be surprises next year.
I'm sure there will.
All right, my honorable mentions. I was just starting to... I've done this for my top tens back, you know, for like 10 years for movies and stuff, where I just at the end have like a paragraph where I list some favorites and write like a sentence about them. And I started writing my sentences and I realized, shit, I played a lot of games this year. I loved a lot of games this year. How many have I listed? It's 10. And it's just like, when you have a second 10, you are contractually obligated to rank them.
Sure, I'm not sure that's how it works, but if that's how you have to justify it to yourself, that's fair enough.
All right, so starting where the other list ended at number 10, let's go to number 11.
All right.
My number 11 was Butterfly Soup, This is the independently developed visual novel by Brianna Lay about a small group of female friends in the California Asian American diaspora. It is so funny. It is so human. It is so insightful. It's the shortest game I played this year, and perhaps the one that made the best, deepest, and densest use of its time. If you have not played Butterfly Soup, it is free, though I would recommend, you know, give her $5 or $10. You know, don't be an asshole. Get it. She'll send you a cool little art book. It's neat. You need to play Butterfly Soup. It's amazing. Number 12 was Nier Automata for me. A game I respect and admire more than I maybe enjoyed, but I love a lot of the things you said you loved about it.
There you go.
It's a cool game.
It's a very good game.
My number 13, this is not a year where either of us had like DLC on our main list, but I did have a DLC on my second 10, which is Shovel Knight Spectre of Torment. This is the second major expansion to the 8-bit throwback game Shovel Knight, this time focusing on the Reaper-esque Spectre Knight, and it completely redesigns all the levels and the gameplay, and it blends like the familiar Shovel Knight stuff with this really unique, like, it's got like a wall jump that's kind of like Batman on the NES or something. It's really, really neat. And it's got the series' most intriguing and emotional little storyline to date. It might be the best Shovel Knight thing, and I really love Shovel Knight. So Spectre of Torment, this was fucking great. 14 is where I had Destiny 2. Destiny 2 is such an interesting game to me.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's better than Destiny 1, but it also threw into relief for me the things that I think are never going to work about Destiny. And I think the ultimate thing is I just think Destiny is a really shallow game. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Its surface is so fun. But it's a game like I play and I enjoy it while playing, and then I look away and I don't remember it. Like,
right.
I just never think of it outside of the bounds of playing the game. And I just, this one especially, like, the campaign is so good. And I have thought about the campaign later and the visuals you see there and the voice acting and some of the crazy things Bungie throws you in. But the end game is very shallow for me. I like the PvP multiplayer. I know a lot of people are pissed at it, but it's still my favorite, like, non-campaign part of Destiny 2. But it's still, like, it deserves some mention in here because it is definitely a defining game of the year. 15 was Puyo Puyo Tetris,
right,
which finally made its way stateside this year. I have logged more than 50 hours in it because I'm a Tetris maniac. So you get a full Tetris game, you get a full Puyo Puyo game. It also mixes the two puzzles. And you get a really zany, really self-aware little visual novel along just to sweeten the deal. And you should totally play it because it's fucking hilarious. So that was fun. 16 was Fire Emblem Warriors for the Switch. So much better than it had any right to be. Like, it feels like a legitimate Fire Emblem game, but also one where, like, you ride around on a horse and, like, lift 70 people up into the air and smash them all down onto the ground into a group of, like, 100 people. So, that's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number 17, we've got a Switch block going on here. Number 17 is Splatoon 2. It's just really fun. And, you know, you get to, like, splash paint everywhere. That was cool.
Cool.
Number 18 was Fast RMX. Another Switch launch game.
I forgot that.
It's a really cool, like, F-Zero-esque racing game. Like, since F-Zero is dead and buried, we've got to look where we can find it. Fast RMX, if you have not bought this for Switch, you totally should. It's a great racing game. Technically, this is an updated Wii U port, but because very few people, including myself, had ever even heard of it until it arrived on Switch, I'm just counting it as new for this list's purposes. Are you going to blame me that no one looked at the Wii U version? Fuck it. Number 19 was Tacoma. I agree with everything you said. I think it's got some problems, but I also love the central gameplay conceit where you explore these big dramatic scenes by moving through them in both time, like rewinding, but also space. You move around the space. That's really cool. And 20 was Assassin's Creed Origins.
Right.
It's long and it's overstuffed, but it's also an amazing visual recreation of ancient Egypt, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I liked the main characters. That was neat. You know?
That's not something you can say about most Assassin's Creed games, in my opinion.
No. I'm holding out hope that one day Assassin's Creed can truly be great and not just like a really good, feeling like a Hollywood summer movie. I want it to get better than that.
Yeah,
and it probably never will, but Origins was still fun. And again, holy crap, I played a lot of games this year.
And at the very least with Assassin's Creed Origins, at least like they finally picked an interesting setting.
Yes.
It had been a while.
And there's other things the game does really well, and I don't want to downplay that. It's a little too shallow for me by the end. But yeah.
All right.
A lot of good games this year.
Yeah.
You gave a lot of silly awards. That was fun.
They were not silly. They were all, every single one was earnest and honest and appropriate and true. They are all true awards and they all deserve them, and I'll be sending out the trophies soon.
Awesome. You've got a lot of trophies. Some, yeah. Hatsune Miku won the most.
Yes, and don't be fooled by my coming up with like half of them while we recorded the podcast and typing them frantically into this document. All those ones are also true awards that I'm also sending.
Awesome. What else do you want to say as we kind of wrap up the year in gaming, in life, in this podcast, everything?
This is obviously a big like video game thing, but I feel like since this is the last podcast for 2017, fucking Twin Peaks, man. Like, feel like we just have to say, we just have to at least address it that it came out this year, because like, what if fucking just crazy, like Doctor Who Season 10 and Persona 5 and Twin Peaks The Return, what an insane block of shit to talk about on this podcast.
I'm kind of looking forward to this next spring we can do other things.
We always have all these plans for like, oh, we can go back and do this idea for an episode that like we've always wanted to do, which like eventually just turned into us saying like, fuck, we're just going to record an extra podcast once a month to do Doctor Who classic stuff, which we've been trying to do forever. Because this year it was like, nope, it's so stuffed.
Like, if we can do a little bit of navel gazing for a moment, like, this year on the podcast was so much fun, and thank you guys for listening to all of it.
Yeah.
This was our biggest year. We recorded the most episodes we've ever recorded. A lot of them were way too long, I know, but it was so much fun, and we had so many cool things to talk about. But it was, yeah, like, there was not really a week this year where we were like, oh, what are we going to talk about? We never had that.
Yeah.
And if we did, it was just like, we just didn't podcast that week, and then we did three the next week or something stupid like that.
Uh-huh.
It was such a nuts year to do this. And actually, like, I agree, like, Twin Peaks, we might as well just mention it again. I don't know. I asked for the Blu-ray set for Christmas from my parents.
So there
maybe,
you go. That's
maybe
smart.
We'll have an
that's
excuse smart. To talk about it. But let me do really quick. I did this on Twitter today. People have been going, like, different writers I follow online are posting, like, here's my five favorite things I published this year. And I didn't really publish enough online writing to do that. But, you know, I did produce 60 podcast episodes.
Yeah.
So fuck it, I can do that. So I did make a Twitter list, and I'm going to go through this with you because I'm curious if you have any others to contribute of, I think, my five favorite podcasts we did this year. And I didn't, like, the top 10 at the end of the year is always a perennial favorite, so
yeah.
I feel it's just always up there. So it's not on this list because we hadn't recorded it yet. My number five for this year was the episode where Doctor Who's episode World Enough in Time aired the same weekend as Twin Peaks Part 8. And we talked about both of those in the same episode. That, like, defines the spring to me, is those two together. And we got into some good conversations, and obviously Doctor Who isn't as weird as Twin Peaks, but those are both, like, weird, formally daring episodes of their respective shows by their respective standards. And it was a fun intersection, you know?
Yeah.
My number four was our Twin Peaks retrospective on the original series.
That was a good one.
We'd wanted to do that forever, and like, I loved, we got to read a bunch of Lynch quotes, and we talked about Firewalk With Me and his other work.
Finally got to watch Firewalk With Me for the first time. That was fucking great.
Yeah. My number three was, we started our classic Doctor Who series after years of wanting to do it. And I just kind of was like, well, which one of the five we've done so far is like maybe the best for these purposes? And I just went with number one, the Aztecs.
Yeah.
Like, they're all, I think they've all been fun podcasts, but you should start with that one. If you've never watched
obviously.
Doctor Who, it's a good one. The Aztecs is so good.
It's so good.
Number two for me was a total cheat, but we spent a month and a half reviewing Persona 5. So this is the complete Persona 5 spoiler cast, which is 10.5 hours long.
I don't think that's a cheat because you did edit them all together into one
thing.
I did. So it is, that's one, it's one thing you published. So.
Yes, we did release it this year. So, and I will say, it is far and away the thing that's been most popular on our YouTube channel, and I do get comments on it from people who have gone through the whole thing.
There you go. I mean, it is comprehensive.
Yes. And one of the five episodes from which that Persona spoiler cast was edited from is our most downloaded podcast ever.
There you go. The people know what they want.
And a lot of
and the people know what we provide.
And there were a lot of downloads from Japan this year, I have to say. Like, I don't know if they understand us, but they really wanted to hear it.
There you go.
So, and my number one was our episode 200. You know, we hit episode 200.
Right,
that
yes,
was cool.
Yeah, that was a great one.
Yeah, we did our top 10 films again. That was really fun. Because we don't get to talk about artistic films like that as much. So it was just neat. But I think we did a lot of good ones this year. I had a lot of fun this year.
I think I just always love whenever we have an opportunity to go really deep into any individual thing. So like I think a lot of like our Gravity Rush 2 one I think is awesome. I think the one where we get to talk about Nier Automata in depth is great. Also, I can't remember which episode it is off the top of my head, but the one after I beat Nier Automata and you hadn't started playing it yet, and I'm like frenzied on the podcast, like, you people don't fucking understand. You have to play this game, like, you have to do it. And then eventually, like, you played it and finished it. I think I, like, posted a comment on there, like, on your Twitter, the tweet that you made about, like, oh, I finally finished Nier Automata and I get it, and I just posted, like, the last four lines from Rime of the Ancient Mariner, because that's, like, that's what that game is, like, you play it, and then you have to go out in the world and, like, tell that story to everyone else so that they can pass it on. So it's like, yeah, like, all the stuff around Nier Automata, I think, was just fun to do on the podcast, because it's such an absurd topic.
Like, different question, not what was your favorite movie this year, but what was your favorite movie that we, like, talked about? In terms of, like, what discussion about a movie was, do you think, our best this year?
This is probably, like, recency bias, but, like, I think our Last Jedi one was really good. Like, we had a little Twitter conversation with one of the listeners about it, and, like, I said on that, that's one of those, my favorite podcast discussions on movies or on games is the one where, like, after I leave the discussion, I like the thing even more. Like, I came in liking it, and then I came out kind of, like, loving it.
Yeah.
That's the best thing, and I feel like our Last Jedi one is really good in that regard. Also, Thor Ragnarok, I thought, like,
that was fun.
Because that's a fun movie, because it's both, like, a fun comic book movie, but had a lot of stuff to, like, actually dig out and talk about, and I got to talk about post-colonial theory for, like, 30 minutes.
Yeah. I agree with Star Wars, just because it was really nice to talk about a really good Star Wars movie that was new. Just, it was cool.
It had been, like, basically 3 years in the running of finally getting a Star Wars movie that I was on board with.
Yeah. So, anyway, and, you know, maybe 2018, hopefully, can be even bigger. We've got our Doctor Who series every month that we're going to be doing. 2018, January, we're going to be hitting the ground absolutely running because we have to review the Doctor Who Christmas special, and then a billion fucking games come out.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, it's going to be nuts. We will not have a dearth of content, let's say that.
Yeah, no, like, I'm like... For a very long time, I've always been saying that, like, video games you need to spread out your release schedule. It's absurd that everything just comes out in fall. And then now, like, it's like the monkey's paw thing of, no, wait, shit. Now there's, like, no time in the year where I feel, like, okay about not playing video games. That, like, it's like, okay, it's fine. Like, I can focus on other things because I'm not missing out on anything big. And now it's like, there's, like, 3 to 4 games in January. Like Monster Hunter World and Dragon Ball FighterZ come out on the same fucking day. Why?
It's not fair.
Why do that?
Yep. All right. Well, thank you guys for a great 2017. I think this was a fun one to go out on. We will be back in 2018. We're going to talk about Mr. Peter Capaldi leaving Doctor Who.
That's going to be sad.
All sorts of stuff. My written version of my top 10, where I pulled some of my comments from today, is going to be up on Friday the 22nd. So that's coming up on the site. Yeah, anything else to close out the year, Sean?
I just want to get back and play some more Hatsune Miku, really. Like, that's just where I'm at in my life. So if we can finish this up, that'd be great.